Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Big time card coming up this weekend. As always, one half your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. And with me to my left, to your right, is Matt Allen with the Raptors hat. You can find him on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. And Matt, what a weekend we had last weekend. I mean, Jiří Procházka taking on Dominic Reyes.
What a night for Fight Night Picks. The question mark kicks it. Procházka gets the win. Holy smokes. If you didn't know, now you know. Let's get into it. Wow.
Huge card for the boys. The question mark kicks parlay hit. And that one, if you've ever missed it, you got to make sure you check out the show. We're live 2 hours before the prelims on Saturdays for those UFC events. Overall, big week in MMA. But Matt, the topic today, we have UFC Fight Night, Rodriguez versus Watterson, a short notice main event, an even shorter known as co-main event, as Diego Sanchez, now recently released from the UFC, Alex Morono stepping in to take on Cowboy, who's on a tidy little losing streak. It's been 5 in a row if you count the Nico Price fight. And again, in that main event, Rodriguez coming in from Brazil, very short notice. Watterson was originally booked in a fight with Amanda Ribas not that long ago. So Watterson's training in the States. You've got Rodriguez coming in from Brazil. And overall, this one at 125 pounds, it is an overall interesting event. What are you thinking this week?
I think I'm a lot higher on this card than most other people are, because I really do think there's just a lot of decent fights from top to bottom. Yes, there might not be the overwhelming star power that you might look for on some of these Fight Night cards. And yes, it might not have a main event that really stands out to you. But anytime Cowboy Cerrone fights, it's an exciting time in the MMA world. Anytime Diego Fajeia fights, it should be an exciting world. And Gregor Gillespie is finally making his return. He's been flirting with us for a while now. He's going to come back and fight Brad Riddell. He was going to come back, well, I guess he comes back this weekend. So should be a really fun event top to bottom, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Should be a great card, Matt. Let's throw it on over to our fight of the night screen, and we want to hear from the fans out there. What do you think is going to be the fight of the night this weekend? As always, the screen presented by Manscaped, so let's throw it over there. For our first pick, possible fight of the night coming up this weekend, we've got Cowboy Cerrone and Alex Morono. Matt, I talked about it from the outset. I mean, Cowboy Cerrone is on a huge downtick. You look at the level of competition, good names, names that you recognize, and of course, his last time out against Nico Price, Florida man. It's considered a no contest. It might show up as a draw. It was a majority decision win for Price, who had lost a point earlier due to an eye poke, but overall, it's a no contest because the guy tested positive for the weed. Now, today, this is Tuesday, as we record getting ready for this, Florida just announced that they're getting rid of the whole marijuana is bad and in competition. So Nico Price, blaze up, buddy. But when we focus in on this fight, Cowboy's on a downtick. For Alex Morono's last time out, he lost to Anthony Pettis, and it was Pettis's big showcase send-off fight. Pettis looked great in that one. Morono just couldn't get started. Before that, huge win over Reese McKee, winning all three judges' scorecards 30-27. And then before that, he got absolutely starched by Chaos Williams. Matt, I'm excited about this fight. But I threw it out there in the YouTube community tab, and if you ever miss us out there, we'll just check in every now and again. And if I could give you one quotable, it's from Todd Drury, who says, "What a joke of a fight," and Rash Daniel, who says, "Who cares is the real question, Matt. I cares about this fight. What are you thinking?"
I care too. Alex Morono has the opportunity to kind of have one of these weird Kelvin Gastelum careers where it's like, hey, we're going to give you legends, and if you can beat them, it's going to do great things for your career. Now, he did lose to Anthony Pettis, so this is kind of his next big opportunity, and beating Cowboy doesn't mean that, oh, you're now ready to fight a guy in the top 15, but beating Cowboy does mean that you're still a good fighter in the UFC, so big opportunity for Alex Morono. And for Cowboy, if he wins this, maybe this is it for him. Maybe they just send him off, and if he loses this, who really knows? So it should be a great fight in the co-main event.
We'll see what happens in this one. Big time fight on our main card coming up this weekend. We have Neil Magny taking on Jeff Neal, and both of these guys coming out of main event slots in 2021. For Neil Magny, kind of unfortunate. He played the game of his opponent, Michael Chiesa, tried to grind on him and wasn't able to do it, and got beat fairly handily. And for Jeff Neal, just got outstruck by one of the best pure strikers in the division. So when we're talking fight of the night, both of our picks are at welterweight. But everybody in and around this division is kind of trying to make some noise. And for Neil Magny and Jeff Neal, opportunities to right the ship here.
100%. Welterweight is one of those divisions where you have such a dominant champion all of a sudden, and he has beaten a lot of the top guys in the division. So if you can get on a tidy little win streak against ranked fighters, you could find yourself in a title fight pretty easily. So for Jeff Neal and Neil Magny, this is a very pivotal matchup at 170, and one that I'm personally the most excited for on this whole entire card. If it was up to me, this would be the main event, but unfortunately, I'm not the one making the decisions, but I do think this could be a phenomenal fight at 170.
Great fight. Make sure you check out the preview as we continue on with the card, but both of these are opportunities for fight of the night. Again, let us know in the comments section who you have as your possible fight of the night, and as always, the fight of the night screen presented to you by Manscaped. Make sure you check out the website. It's manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP for 20% off and free shipping. 3 more months of Manscaped with the boys, so check them out, and it is a great opportunity to be a fight fan. So overall, Matt, what a great card we have coming up this weekend. A lot of people might be sleeping on some of these fights, and your main event, it's kind of a weird one because you have two strawweights and a former Invicta atomweight champ competing at 125. So we'll see what happens overall, but there are some fights that you're definitely going to want to check out. I know my eyes are going to be glued on Phil Haas and Kyle Daukaus. Mike Trezano taking on Ludwig Klein, that's a great one. And then if you want a real striker's paradise, Tefan Chukwue is taking on Jun Young Park, the Iron Turtle. That's a great one as well. So you're not going to want to miss any of the content with Fight Night Picks this week. It should be a great card. I can't wait to start the preview with Matt. So let's go for it. As we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Big time UFC debut. Coming up this weekend, we have the former Brave welterweight champ and Carlston Harris making his debut, taking on the Beast Christian Aguilera. And Matt, really interesting fight in this one, because for Carlston Harris, he was one of those guys that was featured on not Dana White's Looking for a Fight. It was Dana White's Looking FWD to a Fight. I'm assuming that's forward, but if you go back and you look at his last win, he picked up the big finish over Sagid Izagameyev, who was 17-1. That was on a co-promoted EFC, which was Eagles and UAE Warriors card, and it was taking place on Fight Island in and around the time when Dana White tried to go all LeBron James on ABC and had the decision with Khabib Nurmagomedov, where they shut a white door in a boardroom, had a chat, made everybody feel like Khabib was coming back, and then in the end, he wasn't. Carlston Harris gets contract. And if you've ever watched him fight, this guy has a really neat style where he's looking to take you down, he's looking to grind you out, and he does have plenty of finish wins. You look at it, I mean, 15 total, 8 of them by finish, 4 by knockout, 4 by submission, but very much a grinder. He'll go in there, he'll try and snatch a leg, work for a single, work for a double, even bring you up against the cage just to try and knock down your base, wear you out, and finish you. And if he doesn't, then more than likely he's going to win by decision. I mean, again, 15-4, the total record. He's 33 years old, nearly 34, and you don't see a lot of fighters getting their debut, especially at welterweight, being that far up, and I say far up, but being that far up in age, especially being a prospect like that. So maybe an unlikely signing to the UFC. He's going to be taking on Christian Aguilera. And if this guy had a nickname that wasn't the Beast, it would be like that terrible movie that I never saw, Never Back Down. I mean, if you watch a Christian Aguilera fight, the guy's all or nothing. He goes in there absolutely swinging for the fences. He has decent defensive jiu-jitsu. As far as his wrestling, might not be there. I did see a couple of interviews out there. He had one with Sports Kita and our friend JHK, and I'll reference that a little bit later on, but I'll let you take over because, again, little bit of a clash of styles coming up here.
This should be a really interesting fight. For Aguilera, here's the thing. He's going to show a better version of himself than he did in his last fight. Because listen, most guys at 170 are going to get wrestled and just kind of controlled by Sean Brady. We know how good of not only a grappler he is, but just how good of an all-around MMA fighter he was. He was able to prove that really well in his last fight against Jake Matthews. So for Aguilera, I do think he'll be able to showcase a lot more of his skill set in this fight. But it is unfortunate, and I'm just going to expand a little bit upon what you had sort of mentioned. Carlston Harris is kind of in that Jaime Barcelos area where it's like, damn, I really wish this guy was like 5 years younger. Because it really is unfortunate that a guy at 170 is only getting his first opportunity at the age of 33, almost 34, because at 170, It's not like age is going to catch up to you like maybe a Dominic Cruz at bantamweight. You can age a little bit more gracefully. I mean, look, Cowboy Cerrone's in the co-main event. But for Harris, it would have been nice if you could see him in the UFC a little bit earlier so that he could be able to do his run maybe a little bit earlier. But stylistically, I think this is a really tough fight for Christian Aguilera because for Harris, he can do a lot of those things that Aguilera just struggles with. Now, one thing I do like about Aguilera is he does something that it stood out to me. Dinat Bakhri did this in his last fight where he switched stances as he was moving backwards and was able to throw with power. It's actually something that Aguilar is pretty good at doing. He can't do it to the same degree. It's not like he's that accurate with his strikes, but he isn't bad at striking moving backwards for a guy who, yes, like you had mentioned, he is the beast. He is that brawler, but he's a lot more technical on the feet than I think a lot of people give him credit for. Yes, he does try to go in there and wing when he gets somebody hurt, but if he is just striking forward and backwards, kind of that mirror movement striking on the inside, he's not a bad fighter to just pick up points, and he might be able to win rounds that way. But for Carlston Harris, if he is able to get in there, get on the hips of Aguilera, and again, people hate it when I say this and I hate saying it, making it a boring fight and trying to at least extinguish some of those flames that Aguilera comes in with, I do think Carlston can get his UFC career off to the right track.
If you look at Carlston Harris's 5-on-in, we talk about it, especially with the graphics, you look at it, I mean, Sagid Izagagmeyev, he gets the win there, who's 17-1, Alex Santos, 9-7-1, Claudio Rocha at 12-11, that was kind of like a bounce back win. Because before that, he was the Brave champ at 170. Picked up a big win over Carl Booth, a name that people might recognize out of Europe. And then he lost to Jalal Hussein Al-Salawi. And that's a guy that we've been talking about a fair bit with Fight Night Picks, I want to say, because he's kind of like the Brave CF guy that you need to know. It's either Jalal Hussein Al-Salawi or Abdul Abdurghimov. We talked about him in an episode of Keeping Score, which is on our Instagram, at Fight Night Picks. But those are kind of the two guys at 170 over with Brave. For Carlston Harris, though, again, came up, had a fight with Immortal, had a fight or some fights with Brave, with Shuto, and then he has that one fight on a big UAE Warriors card in front of the brass, Dana White, Dean Thomas, a guy who poor Habib thought was who? Who do you think he was? Eve Edwards?
He didn't know who he was.
Yeah, it was really weird. And that was a weird thing to punctuate, but they also punctuated the whole Josh Fabia thing, and look how that turned out. But we get this fight, again, it is interesting, possible clash of styles. If you look at the odds for this one, Christian Aguilera opened a minus 140 favorite. He's now plus 123 or thereabouts on best fight odds for the man himself, Carlston Harris, representing Guyana. He opened a plus 120. He's now a minus 150. And if we have a look at the Tapology votes, because it's fun, we haven't seen these yet, 878 total votes, 74% Harris, 54% by submission for the 26% that have Aguilera, 51% by decision, 37% by knockout. So again, the fans are also thinking clash of styles, and maybe there's a possibility because we did see Sean Brady do it to Aguilera the last time. Maybe Harris is going to do the same thing, take him down, rinse and repeat, and just try and waste that gas tank of Christian Aguilera.
I'm kind of surprised so many fans, though, are siding with Carlston Harris, because I had said before we had started, I wouldn't be surprised if Aguilera can win this fight. I just don't think we saw the best version of him in his last fight. Like, if Sean Brady fought most people in earlier on in their career, they're going to get beat by him, and he's a guy who probably belongs in the top 15, should be fighting the likes of the Neil Magny's and Jeff Neal, kind of towards the top of this card. So, for Aguilera, I do think there's a really good chance that he can showcase a lot more of his skill set. And I do think if he can force this fight to be on the feet, he'll have success. But my issue with Aguilera, it's not that I hate his takedown defense. I hate his inability to create space after someone gets in on his hips. If Carlston gets in on his hips, I do think he can just keep this fight in the clinch up against the cage. And even if he's not able to secure the takedowns, at least keep it in a dominant enough position so that Harris will be the one winning the rounds as this fight goes on. Again, I wouldn't be surprised if Aguilera catches him with a big shot and is maybe able to take advantage of it, but I'm going to side with Harris at the end of the day.
For Harris, you're coming into this one. This fight was even rumored back in February. It's February 25th. MMA Junkie threw it out there. Friend of the show, Nolan King with Farah Hanoun on that one. But if you look at it, Aguilera was supposed to take on Warley Alves back in January, and he had to pull out. He cited, a back injury. He couldn't train full bore for about 4 weeks. So yeah, he's had time to get ready for this one. But again, you just kind of worry about it. And if Aguilera is going to lose, yeah, I mean, he does have the knockout losses on his record, but at the same time, Harris is very, very adept on the ground. He's very positionally aware. I do have Guyana's own Carlston Harris to get the win. I'm really looking forward to the fight. I agree with you on a lot of those points as well, but both of us going with Harris to get the win in this fight to kick off the card. We have a great one coming up. Donald Cerrone taking on Alex Morono in the co-main event. Marina Rodriguez and Michelle Waterson in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. Big time banger. Coming up at middleweight this weekend, we have the Iron Turtle, Jun Young Park, taking on Dodon Tafon Chukwue. Matt, really interesting fight based on fight camps. I mean, for Chukwue coming in here from Team Lloyd Irvin. And listen, we saw one of his teammates recently in Sadiq Youssef coming out on the wrong end against a very well-rounded fighter in Arnold Allen. So he's looking to pick things back up for Lloyd Irvin and crew. And for Jun Young Park, one of his teammates had a very, very successful outing here recently in Daun Jung, who picked up a huge win over William Knight, former common opponent of Tafon Chukwue. So if you look at it in this one, Jun Young Park, very, very good striker. He can kind of sit behind his jab. He can really do a good job of finding his range early. And once he does, if he mixes in some of his takedowns, he can really find a lot of success. And if you want to go back and see a good Jun Young Park fight, what's his last fight? He beat the absolute tar out of Wales, John Phillips. And yeah, was that kind of a bit of a staple, John Phillips' time in the UFC? Well, unless you're Alan Amadovsky, yeah, kind of. But for Jun Young Park, very, very good fight. I did listen to, and I kind of urge people to check it out. And I know, you know, a friend of the show, it's JHK MMA, but he had a great interview with SCMP MMA with Jun Young Park. They kind of talked about the preparations for this fight. They talked about the Phillips fight. And they kind of talked about the stylistic matchup with Tafon Chukwue. And what I got out of it was, listen, he beat Phillips very bad, but he wanted to ground and pound him to get into a submission. And the exact quotable was, "I still lack submission skills, need to work on my ground and pound skills." I didn't love hearing that. He also kind of talked about the fact that Tafon Chukwue, is he good defensively with his grappling and his wrestling? Sure he is. Is he very offensive with his takedowns and with his submission abilities? Not so much. So really, both of these guys are fairly similar as far as their strikers. They're defensively quite sound. Offensively, maybe not the best. And for Tafon Chukwue, I mean, this is a guy that had a pro Muay Thai career. He went 13-1 in Muay Thai, quite a bit of kickboxing. And when he was on Dana White's Contender Series and got that big win, Dana White had the Mike Tyson comparison for MMA. Pretty lofty stuff there.
Yeah, you can calm down on those comparisons just now. He's kind of like Mike Goldberg comparing, who was it?
Travis Luter.
Yeah, Travis Luter to GSP and all those. It was just, it's an odd comparison, a very early one to make at that. But Tafon Chukwue is a very exciting prospect at middleweight with a record of only 5-0. And he is one of those fighters who, I'm going to bring up Carlos Ahlberg for all of 2 seconds, but he's one of those fighters who their MMA record is somewhat deceiving because you do know that their level of experience, especially in combat sports, is a lot more extensive than just what their MMA record looks like. Yes, he only has the 5 professional MMA fights, but like you had mentioned, he has an extensive background in Muay Thai and striking. So for Chukwue, he is such a high-level striker that it will be interesting in this fight because for Jun Young Park, I'll be honest, I don't ever have the best read on him because he is a good striker, don't get me wrong, but in my mind, his wrestling's terrible. I understand it's not, I really do, but in my mind, the fact that he took down John Phillips that many times wasn't that impressive. What he did to Marc-Andre Barrio was much more impressive, though, and I know I've been probably way too hard on Barrio on this channel, but beating Barrio is a much more impressive opponent to go out there and really manhandle than going out there beating a guy like John Phillips, because Barrio's a guy who's been in there with top-level fighters. Like, we were just talking about Christophe Jocko last week, and he had a really close fight with Jocko, so it kind of tells you what level Barrio can at least get to on his best day. And for Park to go out there and really mix up his wrestling with his striking in that regard, I thought that was an impressive performance, and I do really think we're going to see that same at least game plan out of Park in this fight. I expect him to try to overwhelm Chukwue with his volume and then shoot him for a lot of takedowns. Because if you're Park and you're just trying to fight on the outside, you're going to get leg kicked. You're probably going to get outmatched with the power. And if you do start to get backed up, I can see Chukwue landing with big power, especially if he's throwing in combinations. But for Park, again, if he can just throw his hands so much, almost like we kind of saw with Sterling with Piotr Jan, where I'm just throwing my punches so you're not reacting back and you're covering up, I think that could be a good game plan for Park. But I do see this being a very fun fight.
Which is the funny thing, because when we previewed Tafon Chukwue, I went back and watched it, and the Jamie Pickett fight, it was like, okay, well, Pickett, when he has success, and you did see it in that fight against Jonathan Patti over on Dana White's Contender Series, what did he do? He blitzed forward, he did the old Andre Arlovsky, kind of threw his arms out there, and he went insane. It was like a 30-punch combo, finished him, looked great. How do you beat Tafon Chukwue? Well, he kind of struggles with the pressure and the volume. So, if you do think Jun Young Park's going to get the win, for Park, that's probably the way. And if you see it, you look at it. When he fought John Phillips, he outstruck him in total strikes, 260-13. Had 13 minutes of control time. And the scores, 30-25. He beat the brakes off of him. For Tafon Chukwue, you go back and you look at his last fight, the Jamie Pickett fight, where okay, how good's Stefan Chukwue? How much can he mix things in? Because if you do go back, I mean, Jamie Pickett got a takedown in that one. The scores, 30-25, 30-26, 30-26, 159-40 were the total strikes. Chukwue dropped them. Like, he fought a great fight, too. So both of these guys are coming off of very important wins.
Because here's the thing with Chukwue. Here's the added X factor, and Joe Rogan would hate this. For being a guy who's as heavily muscled as he is, he actually has pretty good cardio and a really good level of output to go along with it. Because here's the thing. People have to start judging cardio by how many minutes a person can last before they look tired. I judge cardio a lot more by a person's ability to throw output in a fight and to at least sustain a certain level of output. Like Paulo Costa, does he have bad cardio? Well, not at all. If you can throw 250 strikes in a 3-round fight, then you have good output. You just kind of have to figure out where your output, or you have good cardio, so you just have to sort of level out your output during the fight. With Chukwue, he does have decent cardio for the size of him, so I do think even if he is on the receiving end of one of those grueling style matchups that Parr's going to bring out, even if he is kind of wilting under some of the pressure, if he is defending takedowns, I'm not that worried about his power bar really leveling off in that second and third round. I do think that he can still make this fight somewhat competitive in that second and third round as the fight progresses, but it will be interesting because Park really can use his pace as a weapon in this fight. But if you're constantly moving forward on a guy like Taffon, you're going to be in that danger zone of his big power shots.
If you look at the odds, Jin Young Park opened a plus 160. He's now at a plus 118 or thereabouts, which again, I do find pretty neat. And if you look at Stefan Chukwue, open minus 185. He's now at a minus 143. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, a little bit of a surprise. 913 votes so far. 79% Chukwue, 73% by knockout. And again, both of these guys had very impressive performances their last time out. For Stefan Chukwue, he was making his UFC debut, taking on Pickett, and that was back in December. For Jin Young Park, when he took on John Phillips, that last fight was back in October. Before that, Marc-Andre Barrio, which was December of 2019. And before that, he lost his UFC debut. He was coming in, took on Fluffy Hernandez. But sometimes Anthony Hernandez is going to submit guys. And listen, that's just what happened in that one. The thing that I like out of this, again, for Chukwue, he's training out of Team Lloyd Irvin. There's a lot of good training partners there. We don't have to go through it too much. But for Jin Young Park, I talked about it. Dalun Jung's another guy, especially in the weight classes, 185 and above. And I was going through it. Hyo Jun Lee, he has Sung Jun Lee there as well. And Dong Gi Yang, a guy that you never hear about anymore. But UFC vet, the Ox, and that guy, I get it just from the nickname, big, strong fighter that can take fights to the mat. I think that's somebody that you can train with quite a bit. And I know, listen, he's up in his later 30s, but still, somebody, a body to have in the gym. And if you're going to get pushed and pushed, that's a great guy to have. So overall, I see this fight as being very, very close. And I think the odds kind of reflect that just based on where they're at right now.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be one of those one-way traffic fights. I really do think so. Now, I know we talked a lot about the striking of Park, but if Park's going to win this fight, he has to get the takedown. I really don't think he can just stand on the feet with Stefan Chukwue throughout this fight and not expect to get at least dropped one time, because Stefan doesn't only have that level of power, he's really fast too. And at the end of the day, when you're fighting a high-level striker like him, you're going to have to make it an MMA fight. You can't just stand on the outside. So for Park, I actually think stylistically, he does have at least a skill set that will challenge Taffon, and he should be able to secure at least one takedown throughout this fight. But I do see this being either Park's going to go out there, get one takedown, just control him for the whole round that he gets it, and then rinse and repeat, or Chukwue knocks him out somewhat early on, or maybe later on the fight goes on. I'm going to ever so slightly side with Stefan Chukwue in this fight. I do think with the combination of his leg kicks and his overall output, if he can just keep Park at range for some of this fight and keep his own back off the cage, I do think that with his stand-up, he will be able to get some power shots off, and that will really diminish Park as this fight progresses. I'm not going to say it gets a finish, but I do think Taffon will win this one.
When I went back in the tape study getting ready for this, I watched all of those Stefan Chukwue fights. So if you go through it, against Alex Myers, Myers attempted 8 takedowns. He got none of them. A.T. McCowan wasn't able to do a whole lot. William Knight went 0-5 in one round. Then he took on Al Matavao, who was way too small. He was just a tiny little guy. And he absolutely pieced him up in the two rounds. And then he took on Jamie Pickett, and it was a pillar-to-post win. Stefan Chukwue, great fighter. For Jin Young Park, he has all of the experience, though, in MMA. Yes. And you look at some of the fights, the fight against Glenn Sparv coming in or, you know, on the regional scene. He also has a submission win over PFL sweetheart and welterweight king Ray Cooper III. And he has a loss by submission to Shavkat Rakhmonov. Stuff like that's just going to happen. I like Jin Young Park in this fight. Again, I think if he can pressure in the volume, mix in his whole attack, I think Korean top team is going to get a win here. So I like Park. You got Tafon Chukwe. Sometimes we disagree, but like I said, and I think we both agree on this one, it's such a close fight to call, so I can't wait to hear what people are thinking about this one. Down below in the comments section, let us know. Are you going with the Don? Are you going with the Iron Turtle to get the win? I've got Jin Young Park. You've got Tafon Chukwe. Overall, great card. Co-main event. Donald Cowboy Cerrone's taking on Alex Morono. And in the main event, we have Marina Rodriguez taking on Michelle Waterson. So you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Neat fight coming up this weekend at Flyweight. We have the man himself, Ryan Benoit, taking on the lion, Zaruk Adashev. And Matt, a lot of people are critical when I say Ryan Benoit, but it's not like the rabid Wolverine, WWE's own. Yikes. It's Ryan Benoit, and it's an odd way, especially for Canadian, to pronounce it. It's not Benoit, it's Benoit. Now we can get that out of the way. And for Ryan Benoit, he's taking on a really high level of competition. You might not like the record. It's 10-7, but if I go down through here, let's just pick some of these out. Anthony Berchek, that was an early one. He also took on Josh Sampo, Canadian. Sergio Pettis, Ben Wynn, Freddie Serrano. Okay, well, Brandon, that's Moreno. Fine. Brandon Moreno, Ashkan Mokhtarian. Then he took a long time off, fought Alatang Haley, and that was one that was a really close fight. I know Matt at the time, like going back, thought that Alatang Haley won, but still, it was close. And then he fought Tim Elliott his last time out. That one was back in July. Fairly competitive fight if you go back and look at it. They each threatened with submissions. They were able to get takedowns. They were able to strike. It was a close one, 29-28 across the board. That's fair. Second round, probably the closest of the three, but a competitive fight against a guy who's also been there and done that. Now you're taking on Zaruk Adashev. And Matt, we had this conversation last week, and I saw a lot of people out there in the comments section. Randa Marcos is terrible. She's 10-10-1. All right, slow your roll. Hey, there was a knockout in that fight, kind of, and pretty unfortunate. But Zaruk Adashev is a special kind of 500 because he's 3-3, and you look at it, he lost his debut against Cody Mooney back in 2015. Then he took over 3 years off from MMA. This guy's a kickboxer. He has a 16-3 kickboxing record. He competed with Glory. He's fought some decent names. You go back, like, he's a really flashy striker. And when I hand it over to you, that's kind of the big point you have to hammer home with Zaruk Adashev. But again, level of competition. Cody Mooney was 1-1. Christian Medina, 0-1. Ron Leon, 0-2. That was Bellator 215. In 2019, this guy was fighting 0-2 fighters. He fought Tevin Dice. First round was competitive in that fight. Tevin Dice, all right fighter at 3-1. Second round, finished him. And that's when Zaruk started to gain his confidence. Then he comes in and replaces Ryan Benoit and fights Tyson Nam back last year and gets starched early.
He did get... Oh.
And he missed weight.
Exactly. So this is my problem for Adashev. Right now at 3-3, he is in this weird point in his career, and I'm going to compare him to Joe Rogan's favorite kickboxer, Alex Pereira, because he's kind of also in this same category where I'm pretty sure Pereira's kick or his MMA record, he's like 2-1. As an MMA fighter, he's very inexperienced.
Now he's coming up. He's coming up with LFA, Alex Pereira.
Hear me out though. But in MMA, he's fighting guys who are like 1-1. Guys who should not be in the cage with him because his level of experience is way higher than what it really is. And really, he's going to hurt most guys who are at his level of experience in pure MMA just because he is so good outside of it. Trust me, look up this guy's kickboxing highlights. He is very good. He's not just hype from Joe Rogan. But with Adashev, here's the weird thing. We talk about the flashiness of his striking. He has very fast spinning back kicks, very fast spinning back fists. He's a guy who's not afraid to use his spinning techniques either. He's a guy who can span them sometimes, kind of like Merab Dvalishvili. I know you've been kind of critical on his spinning back fist, but he's a guy who kind of overuses the technique. And I know I've talked about this before with Adashev, but I'm going to keep on bringing it up. I'm going to feed this horse until it dies. I don't know if it's the big gloves that they use in kickboxing. I don't know if it's him worried about the takedown. There's just something different between him and him in kickboxing and him in MMA. And I haven't been able to put my finger on it because he's so susceptible to getting hit to guys who, yes, they're high-level strikers. Like, losing to Tyson Nam by knockout is not the end of the world. And losing to a guy like Sue Muttergee, who is a very high-level striker, is not the end of the world. But when you look at Adashev's level of competition, and when you just look at really what you think his striking or what level it should be at, he hasn't shown that in the UFC up to this point, even in the Sue Muttergee fight. Like, Muttergee's a guy who can get hit quite a bit, but offensively, he's a really tough fighter to deal with. Muttergee just walked forward on him and really didn't have that much respect for the counter-striking of Adashev. With Adashev, I really do think it's one of those cases of when you're moving forward on him, he can strike and he can put things together, but his success really comes from moving forward. And when he's the one who can figure out the range in the fight, that's when he's going to have the most success. It's interesting, though, because if he's the one moving forward on a guy like Ryan Benoit, Ryan Benoit's one of the few knockout artists in this division who, if he does catch you with a big shot on the feet, he's going to put you down.
With Sumat Erji, the thing, too, if you go back, you look at the second round against Zaruk Adashev, Zaruk started to get some confidence, and then the third round, it was just, oh, okay, Sumat Erji's just going to pour it on again. So for Adashev, it's really tough. I mean, he's one of those guys, and we talked about it. You know, recently, you've got Carl Robertson, and he's such a good striker. He's a glory kickboxer. He's so accredited. He also trains with one of the best light heavyweights in the world, and I'm not afraid to say it anymore, beast in 25-8 Corey Anderson. And the combination of those two guys, you've got the wrestling from Anderson, you've got the striking from Robertson, put those two guys together, that could be the best fighter on the face of the planet. If you add the combination of those two, best fighter ever, beat John Jones, mark my words. You look at Zaruk Adashev, he trains at a Nick Cantone MMA. What are they known for? Wrestlers. And you look at it, I mean, Claudia Gadelha, when she went there, had a little bit more success. Frankie Edgar trains there. Lance Palmer's trains there. So on. And Lance Palmer, yikes, against Bubba Jenkins. But you get my point.
A lot of people have lost recently.
But a lot of wrestlers. So for Zaruk Adashev, it could be, am I so afraid of the takedown that I can't open up with my hands? Is it a totally different striking method than just kickboxing with the gloves up there? Because we have seen kickboxers get outstruck recently in MMA by non-strikers. Like, Brennan Allen put on a striking clinic against the man himself, Carl Robertson, not that long ago. It's odd to see. And in a fight like this, you have a fighter, again, Ryan Benoit doesn't have the sexiest record. It's 10-7. But again, if I pick out the losses, Tim Elliott, Alatang Haley, good fighter at 135. Brandon Moreno by split decision. Ben 10 win. Josh Sampo, yikes, but again, that was 2013, and Benoit's had these long layoffs, but training out of Team Oyama for a fight like this, which is where Benoit's coming from, I mean, I would be worried if I'm Zaruk Adashev at the threat of the takedown, too.
Oh, 100%. Ryan Benoit, and I'm going to say it again, I used this comparison once last week to describe a fighter at light heavyweight. Ryan Benoit is your Mike Perry at 125. He has big power in his hands, he has good offensive wrestling, but he struggles against guys who can kind of smother him or guys who are really technical on the feet. But if you're not any of those things, Ryan Benoit, he's got crazy big power for the size of him. And I don't mean that as like a disrespectful way. He just does have big power for the size of him. He's got head kicks. He's got overhands. Like, he's one of the few power threats at that division, not named Deiveson Figueiredo. So when you are in there with Ryan Benoit, you not only have to worry about being taken down, which is something that Adashev just kind of built into his whole game going into MMA. He's always worried about getting taken down. But if you are leaving your hands down, if you are not giving Ryan Benoit the respect he deserves on the feet, he's going to tune you up and hit you with some good shots. I'm not going to say that Ryan Benoit's going to go out there, crack Adashev with one shot and knock him out the first round, but he is one of those guys who, if you're not watching your P's and Q's and you pull out of an exchange with your chin up and your hands down, he can crack you and put you down. So for Ryan Benoit, this is a great fight to get him back on track. He's one of those guys who I do think his record is a little bit deceiving. His skills are a lot better than that 10-7 record show. And even, look, if you lose a split decision to Haile Alatang, it's not the end of the world, but it's rare that you go from losing to a guy to Alatang and then you go up to fight Tim Elliott, who's quite a bit ahead of Alatang in the rankings. But it's not like Ryan Benoit got a lot worse between those fights. He's still just kind of the same fighter every single time in and every single time out. So for Benoit, I don't think we're going to see any massive improvements in his game. I still think we're going to see the same guy. He's going to go for a few takedowns. He's got decent top control. If he gets ground and pound off, that's great. And if he hits you on the feet, that's great too. So I think Benoit's going to be able to get this one done, but I think my prediction for Benoit's more based off the fact that I haven't been impressed with Zaruk Adashev's UFC career at all up until this point.
That one round against Sumat Erji, if you saw that, you combine that with some highlight reel footage over on YouTube, maybe you're a big Zaruk Adashev fan, maybe you like that Nick Cantone MMA connection with the defensive hips, but you look at it again, Benoit with the fight against Alatang Haley, that one was at bantamweight, then he dropped back down to flyweight, got Tim Elliott, who was kind of hitting the skids, and that fight was relatively close. I know it was a decision loss, it was unanimous, and the one against Alatang Haley was a split, but still, relatively close. If we look at the odds for this one, they're also relatively close. Zaruk Adashev opened a plus 190 underdog. He's a plus 123. For Ryan Benoit, opened up a minus 225. He's now a minus 149. If we look at the overall votes over on Tapology, 911 fans have voted. 83% with Benoit, 79% by decision for the 17% that have Zaruk Adashev, 68% have him to win by decision. Yeah, I like Ryan Benoit. Again, it's the level of competition. It's the level and the amount of fights he's had in MMA. For Zaruk Adashev, yeah, the Tevin Dice second round was good. The second round against Sumedergi was good. I mean, maybe we're just dealing with a second round king at flyweight.
We could be.
I don't know, but he's not putting guys out in the second round except for Tevin Dice, who's 3-1. Like, that's, I just have a really hard time. Listen, maybe somebody can make a great case down below in the comments section, but from all of the tape study, from the research I've done, I just can't find myself picking Zaruk Adashev here.
I couldn't agree more. Ryan Benoit's kind of a victim of, he's the same sort of deal of like a Matt Brown. I know you're not as hot on Matt Brown as I am, because not many people are, but it's just the case. When you look at his record, yeah, it's kind of salty, but when you've only fought the best of the best for over a decade, your record isn't going to be crystal clear by the time you get out. Ryan Benoit's 10-7 because he's fought great fighters, and I would rather you lose close fights to good fighters than just beat a bunch of guys that you're supposed to that you're supposed to beat along the way. So no, I agree. I like Ryan Benoit in this.
Ashkan Mokhtarian and Freddy Serrano, the last two wins. You haven't heard of those guys recently, but maybe Ryan Benoit can beat Zaruk Adashev. Matt, we're both going with babyface Benoit to get the win. Can't wait for the card. Co-main event. Cowboy Cerrone taking on a really tough out in Alex Morono. In the main event, Marina Rodriguez, Michelle Waterson. A fighter, Michelle Waterson, that's not afraid to step in a main event opportunity. She gets another one this weekend. Really looking forward to the card. Make sure you keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Straight up, one of my favorite fights on this card. We have the Lone Wolf, Mike Trezano, former Ultimate Fighter winner, taking on one of the hottest prospects you never hear about in Mr. Highlight, Ludwig Klein. And Matt, Peter Bondra, Zdeno Chara, Marian Hossa, Marian Gaborik, all Slovakian athletes, all hockey players that I could think of. But Ludwig Klein making those big impacts in the UFC. He came in last summer on short notice, took on a really tough out in City Kickboxing's Shane Young, and finished him in the first round with a combination from hell. It was a head kick. He swooped in there up against the cage, knocked him out cold. Now, that's the good. The bad, he came in on short notice. He missed weight. Weighed in at 150 for that fight at 145. Listen. Can't make the weight, don't take the fight. But he did look really good in that fight. So Klein's coming in, and he was rumored to take a couple of fights, maybe sort of, kind of, at the end of last year, coming into early this year. For Mike Trezano, kind of in the same boat, because we haven't seen him in the octagon in the longest time. When he fought Grant Dawson, that was almost 2 years ago.
I'm going to be honest, I thought he got cut. And that's just, I'm going to be honest, like, he was gone for so long, and it wasn't like he was, like, the biggest prospect ever. He wasn't getting the Macy Barber push, and I'll let you continue, but honestly, I thought Mike Trezano had got cut from the UFC. I thought they had just let him go, because it makes no sense. You have a prospect who, yeah, they lose the first fight, but MMA is one of the few sports where you either win, and then you lose, or you learn from that loss, and then you get better because of it. So it was just really weird that you didn't see him fight for almost 2 years, and then now he's finally making the return.
So you look at it, he beats Joe Giannetti on The Ultimate Fighter, that was season 27. He wins the season. Now that was a weird one because, again, Luis Pena broke his foot, couldn't fight in the finale. So then they give Mike Trezano Luis Pena, and he beats Luis Pena, albeit by split decision. It was a classic striker versus striker who wants to grapple in Trezano, and Trezano just able to kind of impose his pressure, impose his will, get the win. You go back and watch the fight, it was really close. And then for Trezano, his next time out, he fights Grant Dawson, a guy who had weight issues, 145. And Dawson blew the doors off. Now, for Trezano, he had a long layoff, and he was supposed to fight earlier on this year. And I say early on, we're already in May, early May. He's supposed to fight Rafael Alves, and he had to pull out of that fight, citing an injury. You go back, I listened to an interview with James Lynch not that long ago, All Access MMA, and he said that, he hurt it pretty bad. So you hate to see that ankle injury. He wasn't able to train for a little bit, got back in the gym, got ready to go. And for Trezano, it's not like he comes out of the biggest gym. Oh, wait. He comes out of one of those underground gyms that you never hear about. It's Tiger Schulman. So in his corner, and this is one of those things that he talked about, and I had to write it down. He's going to have Ron Schulman. He's been working out with some really good fighters. Shane Burgos, Julio Arce, some really top-notch guys. Jimmy Rivera as well at that gym. You never hear about Schulman's. And for Mike Trezano, really, really good with kickboxing.
He is, but it's weird because in a lot of his fights, He kind of does the reverse of whatever his opponent does. He is one of those fighters who, when I think of Mike Trezano, I kind of think of an earlier ally in Quinto, where it's okay, I'm a good enough striker to where if you're a wrestler, I can defend your takedowns and force you to become a striker, but if you're a primary striker, then I can reach into my back pocket and I can use my offensive wrestling. And it's kind of what we saw in the Luis Peña fight. He was in there with a guy who was the more rangy striker who could throw a much higher variety, and then Trezano resorted to using his wrestling. So for this fight, it will be interesting, because I do think if you want a comp for this fight, this is a very low level of what Henry Cejudo versus Merlin Moraes was. Because in Klein, you do have the more dynamic kicker. You have the guy who's not only dangerous at very long range, but he's also dangerous up close and on the mat. The only difference is, I think Mike Trezano can take down Ludwig Klein and not have to worry about getting submitted immediately. It's not like Mike Trezano is some scrub on the mat where he's immediately going to get the takedown, then I'm going to be worried about him getting triangled by Klein off of his back. I do think Trezano is going to have to make this an MMA fight, because we talk about his Muay Thai background. He trains with Tiger Schulman's. It's weird because his stand-up game is quite basic. He's not one of those fighters who's going to go out there and really wow you with a lot of his strikes. He's effective in what he does, don't get me wrong. And I do think he's going to have to use his striking kind of as a smothering style against Klein. Like I had said, Klein's really good at close-up. He's got great elbows and knees. He's good on the mat, of course, with his jiu-jitsu. He's good at long range. But if Trezano can make this more of a boxing fight to where he's the one trying to kick out the legs of Klein with that long stance, he's the one trying to box up Klein on the inside, I actually think Mike Trezano could have a lot of success in this fight. And it's weird because Trezano, I think, is one of these guys who we've been talking about a lot more if he was able to use these last 2 years a little bit more effectively. Beating Luis Peña, who's still in the UFC and getting fights, does mean something. And the fact that Trezano was able to beat him so early and so young in his UFC career, and yes, I understand it was young in both guys' careers, but still, for Trezano to beat a guy like Peña and then us not really be able to see him after losing to Grant Dawson, of all people, a really, really good fighter, it just really is a shame that we haven't been able to see Trezano grow in front of us in the cage for the last 2 years.
Well, the funny thing with that Trezano fight, so he fights Peña, and that was, again, like the makeup date for the Ultimate Fighter. He gets the win. Okay, I get to keep the strap. Do you know what card that was on? Let's have fun.
I watched it. I don't remember off the top of my head.
That was on the UFC Denver card, where you had Yair Rodriguez taking on the Korean Zombie in the main event. But you also had Cowboy Cerrone being birthed by Mike Perry. That was that card where they had the throwback graphics. It was the 25th anniversary. That's how long ago this was. Like, we're getting close to what? That was over 2 years ago, bridging on 2 years, 5 months ago. So it was a long time. For Ludwig Klein, the interesting thing was, going into his UFC debut, I had him pegged as a kickboxer. Now, if you're a boxer in MMA, you're not like James Toney was years ago taking on Randy Couture, where you have one skill and it's boxing. I'm Art Jimerson. I'm going to try and grab you and punch you. But Klein was billed as a boxer by Bruce Buffer. Now, you don't always put a lot of stock into how those fighters are billed. Maybe it's Wushu Sanda. Maybe it's Kung Fu with Roy Nelson.
Jiu-Jitsu.
But they had boxing for Ludwig Klein. The guy does have really good boxing, but he's a very well-rounded fighter. He's trained some out of Sanford MMA. He's definitely the much more flashy striker out of these two guys, but he does have technique. Has really good cardio, has decent jiu-jitsu. He's not the best off his back. He doesn't have the best takedown defense, but he has all of those tools out there. So when I looked at the odds for this one, they might be a little rich for my blood. I mean, Klein opened a minus 150. He's a rough minus 251 favorite on best fight odds. For Trezano, he opened a plus 130 at about a plus 200. If we have a look at Tapology to see what the fans are thinking, 889 total votes, 90% Klein, 77% by knockout. Well, Mike Trezano's never lost by knockout as a pro, I can tell you that, because he has one loss, is by submission to Grant Dawson. Is Ludwig Klein going to go out there and knock this guy out?
I think he can, I do. Now, again, it's hard to say something's going to happen that's never happened before, but something's never happened until it does happen, if that makes any sense. So I do think Ludwig Klein does have the striking acumen to at least hurt Mike Trezano. Will I say he's going to put him out? I've seen Trezano eat some pretty big shots, and he hasn't gone out from them. The only problem with Trezano is, here's the thing, he does have good offensive wrestling, but go back to that Grant Dawson fight, and I understand, Grant Dawson's like one of the higher level ground and pound guys and really wrestlers. Just
Leonardo Santos would say that.
Exactly, but he did just destroy Trezano on the ground. Like, it wasn't competitive at all once it did hit the mat, so it does worry me. Trezano will probably be the better grappler in this fight, especially if he does get top position, but it does concern me a little bit. If Trezano does win this fight and tries to use that style where, okay, I'm a good enough striker to get me by, and I'm a good enough wrestler to get me by, I do think he's going to have some tough matchups moving forward. All that being said, I like Ludwig Klein in this fight. I think what we saw against Shane Young was just a little glimpse of what his overall skill set really is, and I do think the UFC has a very exciting prospect on their hands with Klein. And here's the wild thing too, most of the time when Mike Trezano is going to be in the cage at 29 years, I know he's not on the younger side of a prospect, but normally he would be the prospect in this fight. He's the older guy by 3 years, so that just tells you what kind of prospect you're dealing with Klein.
There's two fighters coming up here in the near future that I was excited about last year. Ludwig Klein's one of them, and Denis Bondar out of Ukraine. Those are the two guys that I'm really eager to see. I know Bondar has a fight booked shortly. This is the Klein fight. I have Klein to get the win, but it is a tricky fight. Like, the opening odds make a lot of sense to me. They're going further in the favor of Klein. Let me know down below who you've got in the comments section. But again, I do like the in and out of Klein. I like the side-to-side movement. If he's got to get kind of slick and with it with his jiu-jitsu, maybe he can. I like the Sanford connection. Sanford MMA, Tiger Schulman's interesting matchup. The last time we saw that, well, it's been a little bit, but I love this fight. It should be a great one. Both of us going with Ludwig Klein to get the win. Slovakia represent. We got a great card coming up. You're not going to want to miss the rest of the prediction videos. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big fight coming up this weekend at middleweight. We have Kyle Daukaus, brother of Chris, taking on Megatron Phil Hazmat. We had a great, and still do have a great interview with Kyle Daukaus on the channel, getting ready for his fight against Ali Askab Hezriev, and man, that would have been a great one. Unfortunately, that one was scrapped. They never really said why or based on who, but just overall due to COVID-19 protocols. So Kyle Daukaus has to wait a little bit, and now he gets Phil Haas. And it's an interesting matchup because we kind of know what we're going to get out of Kyle Daukaus. And then his last time out, he beat Dustin Stutzfoot's very, very well. And it's weird that I say that, and that's a weird way to put it, but if you look at it, it was a complete performance from Kyle Daukaus. The striking was all right. The takedowns were good. The takedown defense was good. He really implemented a complete game. He just wasn't able to finish him. For Phil Haas, it was kind of the same thing as last time out. And when you just thought that maybe he was tired against Nassourdine Imavov, he just started pouring the pressure on even more and implementing his game plan with the takedowns. You might have thought, okay, well, Phil Haas, the book's out on him. We've seen his performances. It's kill or be killed. It's, you know, losing to Luis Taylor with World Series, eventual PFL champ, losing to Julian Marquez on Contender Series by finish standing up, or just beating the brakes off of guys like Jacob Malkoon in a fight that they made you pay for in a pay-per-view of UFC 254. And I'll take that one to my grave. But I like the fight he had his last time out against Imavov.
Phil Haas, here's one thing I always like. And as someone, we watch a lot of MMA here at Fight Night Picks. You guys can probably assume that. But Phil Haas, I thought I knew everything I knew about him. He was just kind of that, oh, I can get the knockout really quick, or I could be like Jimmy Manuel and get knocked out. And that's pretty much the story of my career. But in his fight against Imavov, you're right. He showed us something that we never thought Phil Haas is going to be able to do. He showed us kind of that wrestling side of Phil Haas, and that when the going gets tough, Phil Haas will just wilt to the pressure. He can find that second gear. He can get his second win, and he can get tough when the going gets tough. And that's a good thing about Phil Haas, because I was a little worried about his durability. I did see him as kind of one of those fighters where, yeah, he's got all the muscles, and if he can knock you out, that's great. But he does have a bit of that glass cannon-y-ist to his game, and I don't think that's a sign of Phil Haas anymore. I do think that he's a fighter that I held earlier losses against him, and he has evolved into a much more competent MMA fighter than I ever thought he would. So I really do have to give Phil Haas his flowers when it comes to that. On the flip side, people like to get honest. I don't know if they do you, but I know they like me. People like to get honest when we pick a fighter who we've interviewed on the channel, or who JHK has interviewed on the channel. But Kyle Daukaus really is one of those fun prospects who has a really unique style for this middleweight division, because he had one of those fights, and again, he had another fight that you just love to see. It's a fight where, did he lose against Brendan Allen? Yeah, but did he lose any stock? None whatsoever. He got called up on short notice against a very, very tough out in Brendan Allen, and yeah, he lost a fight by decision. A lot of guys lose fights by decision earlier on in their career, but the fact that he got beat so badly in those first two rounds, and then in that third round, Kyle Daukaus was like, yeah, I'm pretty much out of it, but as long as I can just keep on going, keep on trying to get a takedown, I'm going to have success. And the fact that we not only saw Kyle Daukaus get out of sticky situations from Brendan Allen on the mat, who is a tough guy, as we all know, when it comes to the grappling, he had his way with Brendan Allen in that third round. Like, once Allen got tired, Kyle Daukaus is grappling circles around him. That's the neat thing about Daukaus. We talk a lot about there's submission grapplers and there's position grapplers. Kyle Daukaus is kind of that best of both worlds. He can get you in a very dominant position, soften you up with some of that ground and pound, and then once you, I'm going to use the term want to be submitted, because I do feel like a lot of the times in MMA, a lot of people get submitted because they just don't want to be taking the ground and pound shots anymore, but Kyle Daukaus will search out that submission. He can take your back. He can get head and arm chokes. He's just such a dynamic fighter on the mat that really, anytime you're breaking down a Kyle Daukaus fight, you always have to look at how good is his opponent's takedown defense. defense. And I really do think this fight completely comes down to the takedown defense of Phil Haas, because Phil Haas is such a good striker on the feet. He's got that great power to the point where I don't think Kyle Daukaus is going to want to try at all to strike with Phil Haas in this fight. If he will, it will only be maybe to get into the clinch, and that would be about it.
So this is the thing with Kyle Daukaus and his last opponent being Ali Askab Hizriyev. That guy's the weirdest fighter ever. He's all or nothing. Yeah, he's a small guy for the division. He picks people up and throws them. He throws absolute hammers with his hands. He throws head kicks, knocks people out.
He's like Sayer Bahadurizadeh.
He beat the man himself, Paul Harris, who's smaller than Paul Harris. Like, he was a guy, I'm pretty sure I picked him to win in that fight against Daukaus. Like, it's crazy. And then you go and you watch that interview. And I watch a lot of interviews, not just the ones on our channel, but we have a great one with Diego Fajeya this week, so check that one out. But Daukaus was expecting to strike with Hizriyev, and you look at it with Haas, I don't think you're going to strike with Phil Haas. Like, Nasruddin Imavov can, because Nasruddin is great moving side to side. He pumps out that jab. He switches stances. He throws kicks. If you want to see a great Nasruddin Imavov fight, go watch him fight Munier over with Aries. It's a fun. It's a pleasure. It's a treat to watch. Robin Black does commentary. Fellow Canadian. Shouts to Robin. But overall, Nasruddin Imavov, I still think maybe he won that fight. I know you go in MMA decisions, the majority had Haas to win. A couple people scored it a draw, and then like three or four had it for Imavov. I had it for Imavov rounds 2 and 3, but they were very close, and I could understand somebody having Haas to win. But again, Haas has early power. He can carry it. He can wrestle as it goes later on. But as the power bar decreases, if Kyle Daukaus doesn't get finished early, then he can still work away. And that's the thing that worries me a little bit. So when I looked at the odds for this fight, Matt, and I pulled them up on Best Fight Odds, you have Haas open a plus 170. Seemed kind of silly. Well, it dropped really quick. He's a plus 117 or thereabouts. For Daukaus, open a minus 200. He's a minus 143 right now. Really eager to see these Tapology votes. The fans have it really close. Ooh. 886 total votes, 54% Haas. 56% of those fans have to win by knockout. The 46% that have Daukaus, 57% by decision, and 28% by submission. That's interesting stuff.
It is. Here's my problem with Kyle Daukaus. There's one part of his game that I don't really like. He does get hit clean a lot. Like, there's some guys who get hit, but it seems like when they get hit, they're kind of rolling with the shots or some of it kind of glances. Kyle Daukaus can get hit clean, and against Phil Haas, not really the guy you want to be getting hit clean against, but I do think that Kyle Daukaus' overall durability and his ability to scramble even if he does get hurt, because that's the problem that Phil Haas is going to have in this fight. If he drops Kyle Daukaus, he can't jump in to try to finish him immediately, because even if he is in top position against Daukaus, Daukaus is the type of grappler who he can sweep you off the top and he can really get some good ground and pound, and his submission game is just not something you want to risk playing around with on the mat. So I'm going to ever so slightly pick Kyle Daukaus, but I will fully admit Phil Haas is going to have a good chance to knock Kyle Daukaus out in this fight. I just think the durability of Daukaus and his overall cardio is going to be enough to carry him to the win.
And we've talked about it, and especially here recently with these fights, you got a lot of fighters coming out of Sanford MMA. You got Bellator's big guy right now, Jason Jackson, representing the gym.
Michael Chandler.
Kami Barzini over there in a combination with Henry Hoopton. Everybody that they really have.
Burns, Vicente.
The list goes on. But when you look at this, I mean, Ludwig Klein's one of those fighters from the card that's representing the gym. Phil Haas has that great quality of training partner. I'm not taking anything away from Daukaus because, well, of course, he has Chris, heavyweight wonder, and everybody else at Martinez, BJJ, and we've talked on and on about that group. Daukaus has that weird, tricky game. I do like Phil Haas in this fight. I like the punching power. I like the early power. Now, can Daukaus, again, from his last game plan, transition into this fight? Sure he can. It hasn't been that long. He's kind of conditioned for fights like this, so I could certainly see it going Daukaus' way as well. This is a pot and popcorn fight if I've ever seen one, and maybe I flip-flop back and forth all week, because I do see this one as being very close, and I am very much on the fence, but I will ever so slightly side with Sanford's Phil Haas. I think the pressure is really going to cause issues. However, again, to play devil's advocate, we saw Dustin Stutzfus try and do that. It didn't work out for him against Daukaus, albeit he was a much smaller fighter.
I saw Daukaus get 10-8 by Brennan Allen and come back to 10-8 Brennan Allen. That means a lot to me, and maybe I'm one of the few people who still think Brennan Allen's a really, really good 185er, but the fact that he was able to take so much damage, get controlled, and basically have no hope in the fight of winning, and then come back and look as good as he did in the third round, that does mean a lot to me, even in defeat. And then to look as good as he did in his last fight, I do like Daukaus in this one, but it should be a phenomenal fight at 185.
Matt going Daukaus. I'm going with Phil Haas. Love the fight. Really want to see what you're thinking out there. Who do you have to win? Phil Haas? Is it Megatron? Or do we have Chris's brother, Kyle? Is Kyle Daukaus going to get the win? Matt's got Daukaus. I've got Haas. Love the card. Cerrone taking on Morono in the co-main event. In the main event, you better stick around for it. Rodriguez taking on Michelle Waterson. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time heavyweight banger coming up this weekend. We have Ben Rothwell taking on Felipe Lins. And Matt, for Monstro, it's been bad in the UFC. I mean, this is a guy that won the PFL heavyweight tournament not that long ago. And that's the thing, too. You look at it, I mean, he had a great season. He lost to Vadim Nemkov over with Bellator. It's going to happen. He lost to Kleber Silva. It's going to happen. And then you look, and he beats Alex Nicholson. Jared Rosholt, good wrestler, finishes him. CO Alencar, and then Josh Copeland, the Cuddle Bear. And he wins the season, and he wins $1 million. And it's like, hey, Felipe Lins probably going to compete with the PFL again. But he missed the 2019 season due to injury. He was booked with a one-off spot with Satoshi Ishii, the Olympic caliber wrestler. And then he ends up in the UFC, and he's booked with a teammate in Andrei Arlovsky. And it was like, okay, what's going to happen here? This is weird. You rarely see teammates, let alone heavyweight teammates at American Top Team fight. But that's what happened. And he kind of didn't get started. And then he fought Tanner Boser. And he kind of started to throw the leg kick out there, and then he gets starched. So he's been booked since the Boser fight with Dontayle Mays and then Ben Rothwell. And he was injured going into the fight against Mays, so he had to back out. And then there was an undisclosed injury. I really tried to find answers on this. If somebody knows, drop it down below in the comments section. Topology says undisclosed. Nobody really said who is injured, so I don't know if it was Lins, I don't know if it was Rothwell, but somebody was injured and pulled out of that fight. What I do know about Big Ben Rothwell, Matt, before I hand it over, was if you go and watch the embedded going into UFC 260, geez whiz, Stipe Miocic is going on to the plane, and he goes to sit down, and there's Ben Rothwell across the aisle. So they're talking, and there's people in between, and he's like, who are you going to fight? Because he sounds like Boomhauer.
Poor Stipe.
But he does the Boomhauer, and then Ben Rothwell goes, Felipe Lins? And then Stipe's like, who? And neither one of them really know him. The guy's made so much money, but he hasn't looked good in the UFC. And he knows he has to start to pick it up, and I've got a good quotable for later on, but this is a weird fight, Matt.
You sound like every Conor McGregor fan, where they're just like, but he made so much money. If only money made... Felipe Lins isn't that good anymore. And was he ever that good? Hey, you could be the judge of that. But if you lost to Vadim Nemkov, who, yes, is very good at 205 pounds, it's a little concerning. And then the run that he went on in PFL, listen, beating Jared Rosholt in 2018 doesn't mean anything to me. I'm sorry. He was a good wrestler at one point, but there's a reason that he got cut from the UFC all the way back in 2015. It's been a while since Rosholt's been relevant to the sport of MMA. Really, he has not been a high-level, really, UFC heavyweight ever, and MMA heavyweight for a very long time. The Copeland run was nice, don't get me wrong, and the fact that it was a TKO in the fourth round, it's just a nice show from a heavyweight, because we don't really see a lot of those later stoppages in the heavyweight division. But look what he's done in his UFC career. He didn't do anything against Andrei Arlovsky, and you're probably like, well, Matt, he did something. Did he, though? He did just kind of stand there and watch as Andrei Arlovsky would sometimes blitz in and throw just a lot more volume than Lins could. But you're right, that's the best way of describing how Lins looked in that fight. He just never got started. And it is a case, we see this a lot, where there'll be a fighter, you have a bad round, and then your corner's like, hey, figure it out, and then you look better.
So, I've got a quotable on this one. Felipe Lins coming into a fight with Ben Rothwell. You know what you're going to get. Oh, the herky-jerky movement that he doesn't really use anymore. Ben Rothwell is pressure, smother, and I'm going to land some uppercuts in the clinch. And if you want to watch the most just boring fight, it's when he fought Ovince St. Preux. And they just kind of moved around. And then Ovince would go back to the cage and Ben would land a couple times. And it was boring. Then he fights Marcin Tybura, and Tybura smothers him. It was a decent fight. It was better because, listen, I wasn't looking forward to it. But with this fight, I am, because Ben Rothwell, late in his career, you win some, you lose some. Felipe Lins is losing. So again,
I'm calling you out right now, Craig. Felipe, there's no way you're more excited for this than you are Tybura Rothwell.
Felipe Lins in the UFC has looked like he's been fighting in a mirror. If you watch KB Buller last weekend against Andreas Mihailidis, it was like, okay, I'm going to do Taekwondo in front of the mirror now. And he threw axe kicks to nothing. And he threw question mark kicks that meant nothing. And he threw leg kicks just to tap. Like Matt practicing pitching out in the yard. I'm just going to throw it against the door. Maybe one day I'll end up in the majors. KB Buller did that. Felipe Lins, it's like, hey, I'm just going to do this in the mirror, land a couple of times and do nothing. This is the quotable, and he was interviewed by MMA Junkie in the last 4 days. Here it is. It's hard-hitting stuff. He said about Ben Rothwell, he hits hard, has a good chin, doesn't run from a fight. I have to be intelligent when facing him. I need to combine all my skills so I can impose my own game. I can't fall into his and get into a brawl. All right, Felipe, where have you been?
He hasn't been fighting in the UFC. Like, that's just the thing. We've seen a shell of the fighter that we were kind of promised, if you will, coming over from the PFL. And here's the thing.
It's a shame.
A lot of people know that Craig is a bigger PFL fan than myself. I'm not the biggest PFL watcher. But no one proves my point more than Felipe Lins. Because Felipe Lins did look like such a world beater over there. And then you see him against an old Andrei Arlovsky, and he looks awful. And then he gets finished by not really a heavy-handed heavyweight in Tanner Boser. And Boser's a decent striker, but it's not like Tanner Boser's known for getting a lot of first-round finishes, more of a decision-oriented heavyweight than he is just some heavy-handed guy. So Lins has just looked awful in the UFC. Unless he does show me some version where I'm like, wow, I'm really surprised. I just don't know how he does beat Ben Rothwell. At least I know what I'm going to get from Ben Rothwell. I'm going to get the forward movement. I'm going to get good output from a heavyweight. Nothing crazy. It's not like he's Max Holloway, but decent output. And he's a guy who has really underrated chokes in the clinch and on the ground. Ben Rothwell's a decent grappler. A lot of people forget. He did choke out Josh Barnett. And yes, Josh Barnett was old at the time, but Josh Barnett, yeah, it's one thing to knock out Josh Barnett. Like, that's impressive, don't get me wrong. But if you submit Josh Barnett, who's one of the greatest catch wrestlers of all time, shout out to Shayna Baszler, the only catch wrestler trained, the only female catch wrestler in North America at one point. I'm not sure if that still stands. But aside from the Shayna Baszler facts, I do like Ben Rothwell in this fight. I don't think Ben Rothwell is going to be going in there and beating guys in the top 15. It's not like Ben Rothwell is going to be the guy to go out there and beat, like, the Derek Lewis's or the Francis. I doubt he's got one of those runs left in him. But I do think he's going to be able to do enough to beat Felipe Lins. I just think Rothwell, he's going to be in that kind of the Boser category, the Lins category. Like, Rothwell, I don't ever think is going to get past that Tabora, because Tabora right now is number 15. So I don't think Rothwell is ever going to go on a run and get back into the rankings, but I do think he can offer you some fun fights with guys like Lins outside of the rankings.
Matt, when you beat the War Master, you get high praise from Mr. Matt Allen, and if we focus on the odds here, they're close. Rothwell, open a minus 105, he's about a minus 113. For Lins, he opened a minus 115, he's about a minus 110. So Lins is slightly favored. If you have a look at the overall Tapology votes, 960 of them, 78% Rothwell. And you got 62% by decision, 30% by knockout, Matt. 2% having to win by submission. If you look at Felipe Lins, he's been knocked out by Kelly Anunsen. That one was a knee injury in 2014. Kleber Silva, Vadim Nemkov. Boser knocked him out. What else? That's it. So he's only ever been knocked out. He's never been submitted. Maybe you have an opportunity here. Maybe you like Rothwell by submission. Listen, Ben Rothwell's not the same Rothwell pre-suspension. And if you look at him recently, again, we bring up some of these names. But since he's come back, he's lost to Blagojevanov in a boring fight. Andrei Arlovsky, not the most enjoyable fight. He finished Stefan Struve, but let's get it straight. Dan Mergliotta coached him into coming back up after the two nut shots. And Ben Rothwell, pretty easy to finish a guy that's been kicked in the cubes twice. And then the OSP fight was the most boring fight I've ever seen.
Okay, stop. No, it was. OSP dropped Ben Rothwell twice in that fight, and Ben Rothwell hit him with a lot of volume. It wasn't that bad of a fight. Like, OSP moving backwards was able to drop Ben Rothwell, and Rothwell was moving into his power. I don't think it's one of the worst fights ever. I just think it was one of those fights where you know what you're getting from Ben Rothwell. This fight's going to go just like how that fight went. Either Lins has enough power to hurt Rothwell as he moves in with his volume, or he doesn't. And honestly, I don't think he does. I don't think Felipe Lins belongs in the UFC, and I think if he loses this fight, it's probably it for his UFC career. So I'm gonna go with Ben Rothwell overwhelmingly.
Matt, that's yikes. I'll go with Rothwell. I don't love it. I don't love the fight. This is much a pop and popcorn fight if I've ever seen one. But Matt used the word overwhelmingly, so take that with the biggest grain of salt. Matt, we're both going with Ben Rothwell. Yikes, to get the win. Big time card coming up. You got Donald Cerrone taking on Alex Morono in the co-main event. In the main event, Michelle Waterson and Marina Rodriguez. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Couple of strawweights battling it out. And listen, both of these women have fights against the two fighters in our main event. You got Waterson, you got Rodriguez. But here, it's Amanda Ribas taking on Angela Overkill Hill. And for Angela Hill, it's kind of been a career resurgence. I mean, people forget, she came into the UFC with less than five fights. She came into the UFC with a lot less than five fights. And what she's been able to carve out for her career is so, so interesting. She has a great win somewhat recently against Loma Lookbunmi, where she outstruck the striker. That was a neat one. And if you look at the five on in, 3-2. Again, we talk about the Lookbunmi fight after that. She loses a split decision to Claudia Gadelha, the most 500 fighter out there. Of late, she loses a split decision to Michelle Waterson. Her last time out, she beats Ashley Oder in a fight that was back and forth. There were takedowns, there was striking. It was an enjoyable one. For Amanda Ribas, was she the biggest star rising at strawweight for a little bit? I mean, she was. She had some quality wins. She beat Emily Whitmire. Her dad got the big tattoo. She beat Mackenzie Dern. That was huge. She beat Randa Marcos. She beat Paige VanZant and submitted her. And then she lost to Marina Rodriguez her last time out. And if you watch that fight, I liken it to a baseball player, and take your pick, Alfonso Soriano, where we're doing the toe tap thing. And if you watch Marina Rodriguez, she's kind of like baiting her in. She's toe tapping with her left hand, like, I'm going to throw the hook, I'm going to throw the hook. She throws the left hook and completely whiffs. But the best part is she follows it with the right, completely cracks Ribas. She drops. Rodriguez follows it up. And then Herb Dean steps in. He goes, okay, is the fight over, Herb? Like, what are we doing? No, I'm just going to back off and let it continue. And it was one of the worst stoppages I've seen lately, which is saying something. Rodriguez finishes it up. Ribas knows it's done. But for Ribas, she has to regroup. And again, her last loss was Pollyanna Viana back on the regional scene. It was a long time ago. Jungle Fights back in 2015. She lost by knockout. She comes back, gets a win, ends up in the UFC. So Ribas has been there, done that. She's had to regroup. So has Angela Hill. So this is kind of a comeback fight. I know Hill won her last fight against Yoder, and that's a good win. People might discount it based on Yoder's record, but overall, scrappy fighter. For Ribas, though, it's a tricky one.
I'm really excited for this fight. I'm as excited for this fight as I am for the main event, because I'll be honest, I thought Angela Hill beat Michelle Waterson. Now, that was a great fight, and I should give that fight the respect it deserves, because I'm going to talk a lot about that decision with this fight and then, of course, the main event. But it was a great fight between those two ladies, really back and forth action, just a great striking battle between those two. But I did think I thought Hill should have got the nod at the time. For Ribas, here's the thing, because you would think, I think Mackenzie Dern should be fighting for a title soon. I said that in a recap show. It's out there, okay? I think Mackenzie Dern should be fighting Rose Namajunas probably next, or she's one fight away. So you would think, well, Ribas beat Dern, so Matt probably really likes Ribas. No, because people have to remember this. I hammered this point home so many times before the Nina Nunes fight with Mackenzie Dern. I said, hey, when you come back after a long absence where your body changes a lot, like it would through a pregnancy, you need one of those fights under your belt. You just kind of need one of those throwaway fights. Amanda Ribas was Mackenzie Dern's throwaway fight, and I think people need to remember that. The Mackenzie Dern that Amanda Ribas beat was not the one that we've seen in her last fight against Ansarov, or the one that we've been seeing as of late. It was a very different fighter, and a fighter who was much more green in their striking, but a fighter who I just don't think was necessarily ready for that fight at that time. She had just had her kid only 3 months earlier, and then she was making that quick turnaround to fight Ribas. So for Ribas, it's weird, because you beat someone like Dern, who then goes on to just keep on winning. So really, you can only go in there with other top-level fighters. But they used her win over Dern to more market her star potential and not to really nurture her talent. And they gave her Paige VanZant. Up a weight class. And beating Paige VanZant is great, don't get me wrong. It's going to do great things for your personal brand overall. But beating Paige VanZant in MMA doesn't mean anything. It's very much a boxing setup fight for an MMA fighter to have. Because what does Paige VanZant have? It's kind of the Chael Sonnen theory. I want the easiest fight for the most amount of money. Well, Paige VanZant kind of is that for a lot of people in these weight divisions. And that's what Ribas got. So a lot of people were high on Ribas because, wow, she beat two of the bigger names in the division, but not really the two best fighters in the division. And then you go in there with Rodriguez, who is a big, big power puncher for the division. She loses that fight. I just don't really know where Ribas goes in this big division, and that's what's great about the Angela Hill fight. Angela Hill has straight up fought everybody at strawweight. Whether you're ranked number one in the world or whether you're ranked 25th in the world, Angela Hill will still take a fight with you, and she probably has fought you. And that's the great thing about Hill. If you beat Hill, then I know exactly how good you are. I know you can go in there with anybody from 10 to 15 and beat them, and you can offer anyone from really 5 to 10 a tough fight. So if Ribas is able to get over on Hill, I think she's right back on track to what we thought she was before the Rodriguez fight. Especially if she goes out there, let's say she can get the submission win. Ribas is phenomenal on the mat. That is the one area that Hill can be susceptible towards. Then I do think Ribas is right back on that track, and there will be those bigger fish to fry out there for her. But for Angela Hill, if she can keep this fight on the feet and really take advantage of some of the holes that we saw in Amanda Ribas' striking defense in the Rodriguez fight. I think Angela Hill can have a lot of success in the feet in this one.
And it's so interesting, and if you listen to the commentary, and I would in the fight between Hibas and Rodriguez, sometimes I listen to it and I mute it, sometimes it's a little too one-sided. In that fight, it kind of is, because they're critical about the fact that Hibas isn't cutting the cage, he's just kind of following Rodriguez. And if you look at strikers like Rodriguez and like Angela Hill, they can cut angles, especially on their back foot. You don't see a lot of great strikers on their back foot that can throw volume and good counter shots. Angela Hill's a fighter that can. I mean, this is somebody, too, that just like Jimmy Manuel, and I know it's a poor example, but it's the one that I think of. Jimmy Manuel only started boxing when he was in his late 20s, early 30s, and then brought it on in MMA. Angela Hill got into Muay Thai really late, got into MMA really late, and then all of a sudden Angela Hill had a ton of success. You just don't see, like, Ed Jovanovski was like 16 when he started playing hockey.
Jim Mann was built like a Greek god.
And then Ed Jovanovski ended up captaining big teams and having a good career in the NHL. Like, it just doesn't happen where you get into a sport late and just bam.
Tim Duncan?
Tim Duncan. But it doesn't happen all that often, all right? You know what I mean? Listen, so you look at this fight. Hibas, I've seen her from the Instagrams. If you want to peep it, she's got like 750,000 followers over there. It's insane. She's been training at the old family gym, which could work for her. I mean, Marcelo, listen, he's done wonders so far, so it could work well for Hibas. And listen, we kind of talked about it. Luana Pinheiro coming in last weekend against Randa Marcos. I just want to say this. She started judo at 2, and I watched the fight with my wife, and I said, you watch her. Like, she's going to do head and arm throws and stuff. You're rarely going to see. And Pinheiro lit Randa Marcos up with those throws. It was great. Hibas, again, where you get that kind of personalized one-on-one training like Pinheiro would have with her family, it could work great for Hibas. It's just kind of different. If she hasn't spent any time in American Top Team like she did before, and she's just training in Brazil, it'll be interesting to see how that kind of works in a fight like this.
Worked great for Dean Thomas, Jillian Robert. Here's the problem with Amanda Hibas. We had kind of referenced this going in, or leading into the fight against her and Rodriguez. She cuts a tremendous amount of weight to make 115 pounds to the point where it's coming out like fight week. It's like, oh, she's got like 24 pounds, which is a lot for anybody. Like, a middleweight would cut about 24 pounds. So the fact that she's cutting that much weight to make 115 is very concerning. And I do think it does play into her overall durability, because it's not very often that you have a fighter at 115 pounds with only 2 career losses and them both coming by way of TKO. I do think she's a fighter who, if she doesn't do everything right with her weight cut and isn't in really the 100% fitness level that she should be, I do think that weight cut takes a toll on her on the feet. And if she is fighting someone like Angela Hill, who we know is that great pinpoint accurate striker, I do think Hill, who I guess isn't really traditionally known as a heavy-handed striker, she's a good striker but not really a knockout artist, she might look like a much more powerful striker against Hibas, because Hibas could be a little bit more fragile due to that weight cut. So that is a narrative moving more into question mark kicks, not really to promote that show too much right now. But I do think that's something that is always a narrative when you're talking about Hibas standing at 115 pounds. She got a tremendous amount of weight, and it could play into effect with her durability over time. I am ever so slightly going to pick Amanda Hibas in this fight, because if you look at Angela Hill, and if you do look at her recent losses, throw out the Michelle Watterson one, because that one was primarily contested on the feet, and that one really came down to what do you look for more when you're judging a fight. But just go back to the Randa Marcos fight. We talk about Randa Marcos a lot, how she's basically a 500 fighter. That fight wasn't that long ago, and she was able to submit Angela Hill. And really, once the fight got on the mat, you could tell that Randa Marcos was going to not really have her way, but there was just levels to it once it got to the grappling. I do think Amanda Hibas is a much better grappler than even Randa Marcos, so if she is able to secure the takedown, I do think she will be able to get that submission over Angela Hill.
It's a tough one for me. I mean, you go back, you look at Hill's second to last fight. It was a fight of the night, split decision. Michelle Watterson, she loses. For Amanda Hibas, she was supposed to fight Michelle Watterson back in January. Watterson had to withdraw from that one. For Angela Hill, coming into this one, again, you talk about the win over Ashley Yoder. Very well-rounded, gritty performance, the type you expect. If you look at the odds in this one, I was halfway surprised. Hibas opened minus 175. She's minus 180 or thereabouts. For Hill, she opened plus 150. She's still roughly there. If you have a look at the Tapology votes, might come as a bit of a surprise. 949 total votes, 75% Hibas, 62% by decision. The fans are going Hibas big time.
I do like Hibas quite a bit. I know I brought up some red flags based on her last performance, but the issue is that Angela Hill doesn't beat fighters like Amanda Hibas. Here's the thing about Amanda or Angela Hill. Most of her wins are those Thomas Almeida-y wins, where she's beating people that she should beat. Like, you might say Loma Lookbunmi, wow, that's a great win, but that's her best win. And I don't think Loma Lookbunmi is going to be taking this division by storm anytime soon. So for Angela Hill, again, there's just such a big discrepancy between her wins and her losses. Beating Hannah Cyphers and Loma Kolopomi don't prove to me that much. And yes, I thought she beat Michelle Waterson, but even Michelle Waterson, as we're going to get to in a little bit, I don't think the highest of her. So I do think if Hibas can get this fight to the mat, she's really going to have her way in the grappling department against Hill. I think Hill's decent enough defensively that she'll be able to defend a few of the initial takedown attempts, but I do think it's just a matter of time until Hibas is able to get this fight to the mat, and once she will, she'll be able to do it. She'll be able to submit her. My problem is, Hill's a good striker, but not a power striker, and I do think you need some kind of power to really beat someone like Hibas. I could be proven wrong in this fight, and I do think this fight will be one of those fight of the night contenders, but I do have Hibas at the end of the day.
It should be a good one. It's a really tricky one, and again, for Hill, you get totally taken down and washed. I mean, you look at the training partners that she had at, or has, at 10th Planet San Diego, the Alima Leigh McFarlands of the world. Couple that with Alliance, you get the Jessica Penne's, and so on and so forth. You're going to have some good competition to train with, especially for a fight like this. Coupled with her striking and her volume, if she can just keep things on the outside, stick and move around like we know that she can, Angela Hill has a good opportunity. I like Hill as the underdog in this fight, especially at about a plus 150. Listen, I'm going to disagree with the fans. Can Hibas come back? We saw it. I mean, listen, you lose to Vienna, you end up in the UFC, you beat Mackenzie Dern, you beat Paige VanZant, and Bob's your uncle. We're off to the races. But I do like Angela Hill in this fight for all of the reasons that I listed earlier on. So I'm going to go with Hill. You're going to go with Hibas. It's a very interesting fight. Maybe one of us has a change of heart. Again, we get to see the weigh-ins on Friday, and on Saturday we have question mark kicks. So you're going to want to tune in for that. That's 2 hours before the prelims. We offer up our final picks. Those ones are the ones that go under the leaderboard. So Matt, I'm really looking forward to this fight. Yeah. And the entire week, keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. One of the most interesting fights on this entire card, we have Brazil's Diego Ferreira taking on Gregor the Gift Gillespie. And for Gillespie, he was already gifted a co-main event slot. He's supposed to be taking on Brad Riddell, but unfortunately with Riddell, the Volkanovski camp going into his fight against Brian Ortega, there were some COVID complications. So Gillespie has to regroup, and he was initially supposed to take on such an accredited striker in Riddell to now a really dynamic fighter in Diego Ferreira. And you might be down on Diego because he had that weird split decision loss to Benil Dariush in their rematch, which is pretty much a carbon copy of their first fight. And you might say, well, listen, he lost that fight. I think he lost that fight. You think he lost that fight. JHK might have given him a little bit too many props over in the interview, which is on the channel. You got to check it out. But the whole of it is, Diego Ferreira is a good striker. He's a really crafty striker, and he gets it. And he talked about that with JHK. They said, listen, you know, you have so many training partners at Florida, so many guys that really push me. I kind of get nervous about sparring there because it's with the likes of, like, an Abdulrazak Al-Hassan and so on and so forth. Like, I got to really kind of keep my head on tight and worry about these guys. So for Diego, you look at it. He's got his own gym. He's so good at jiu-jitsu. He's so good with his top pressure. And you've seen that out of a lot of his fights. I mean, who do we have to kind of pick on? The Anthony Pettis fight?
That was a great performance.
Looked great in that one. The only thing that you can really pick out is when Diego fights the really, really good wrestlers, the really, really good strikers. Sometimes he doesn't come out on the losing end. Sometimes you fight Dustin Poirier and you get finished. It happens. Sometimes you lose 2 times to Benil Dariush. And there's a lot of top control in those fights. About 7 minutes plus, 7 to 8 minutes of top control for Benil in both of those fights. Now he's taking on the highest level of wrestler you have out there in Gregor Gillespie. Like, this is like Olympic caliber wrestling, coupled with, I wouldn't say the best striking, but all right striking in Gregor. He's a guy that trains at a Belmore Kickboxing in New York. And we've seen some fighters like the Andre Harrisons kind of posing in the pictures, the World Series and PFL fame Andre Harrison. But from Gregor Gillespie, it's just the fact that he got put on the biggest posters last time out that I think really draws back from this fight.
It really does, and it sucks, too, because, like, you know how once a year Giannis will get put on a poster and then people try to clown him, they're like, ha, is he the MVP? Well, yeah, he is. Like, that individual play does not sum up that person's whole resume, and it does suck, because the only memorable thing about Gregor Gillespie's career up until this point, and again, that sounds very disrespectful as I say it, but that's probably Gregor Gillespie. Like, his best win is probably over Vince Paichel. He beat Yancy Medeiros. A good win. Like, he has
the Jordan Rinaldi fight was good.
Jordan Rinaldi's okay at best. So again, those performances don't really stand out. That's the problem for Gregor Gillespie. I think his skill level is at a much higher level than what his opponents have been at up until this point. Like, Gregor Gillespie hasn't had a competitive fight in the UFC. Even in his loss, it wasn't all that competitive. Now, yes, it was a little back and forth on the feet up until the finish, but Gregor Gillespie, he either has 100% top control, dominant wrestling in his fights, and he just frustrates his opponents to the point where they either give up the neck for the submission, or he's able to ground and pound them just by the fact that his opponent really can't get up to their feet. Look at the Yancey Medeiros fight for that. But Gregor Gillespie, when I think of Gillespie, really the first thing I think about in his game is just the absurd physical strength he must have. Because he is one of those fighters that you just look at and you're like, how is he able to just hold these people like Jordan Rinaldi, like Vince Paichel on the ground, who are big guys for the weight division, but you just see the ease that Gillespie has with really grounding these fighters. It's impressive. And this fight will be interesting because for Gillespie, I know he's been out for a little over 2 years, and I'm sure his game has grown a little bit in that time, but I still think Gregor Gillespie is going to be that same fighter that we saw in the Medeiros, the Paichel, and the Lee fight. He's going to strike a little bit, but when the going gets tough, he's going to resort to his wrestling. But against a guy like Diego Fajeia, who is so crafty with the scrambles, who's so good at jiu-jitsu, who can strike too, it'll be interesting to see what does Gillespie do if A, he can't get the takedown, or B, if Diego can get on top of Gillespie, because this is the one difference in this fight. If Gillespie's on top of Diego Fajeia, yes, he might get some ground and pound off, yes, he might get some good positions, but it's not a game over stage for Diego Fajeia if he's on his back. If they're in opposite positions though, and Gregor Gillespie is under Diego Fajeia, it's over. I'm almost like, I cannot describe the difference in their levels of jiu-jitsu once it's on the mat. And if you have a wrestler on their back against someone like Diego Fajeia, who is so high level, it's going to spell disaster for Gillespie. But this fight really is just so interesting because both guys are really well-rounded. And the fight that I really like from Diego Fajeia was his fight against Mirbek Taisimov at UFC 242. Because Taisimov was that, like, he was the original dark horse of the division.
His legs are giant, his takedown defense is great, he can knock out a horse, and now he's fighting with a bit of a hometown advantage in that one too.
Exactly, but he was one of those fighters. He was the original Benil Dariush. He was the original Diego Fajeia. He was the guy who the rank fighters don't want to fight because he doesn't have a big enough crowd behind him. He doesn't have that many fans, but he's such a dangerous fighter. Diego Fajeia, oddly enough, had insane cardio in the hottest arena ever and just beat the brakes off Taisimov, put on the feet. And that was the most impressive part about that fight because Taisimov had so many first-round stoppages, just so many stoppages up until that point that if Fajeia won, you had to assume that he was going to make it an MMA fight. And the fact that he really was able to show that his striking had reached that other level was just so impressive from Fajeia. So for this fight, I think if it's on the feet, Fajeia's going to have a lot of success with the somewhat basic striking of Gillespie, but I do think Gillespie's going to be able to get that takedown throughout this fight.
And that's the thing, like, you look at Gregor Gillespie overall, his entire body of work, maybe not the best names. I mean, again, Glico Franca, Andrew Holbrook, Jason Gonzalez, Jordan Rinaldi, Vince Paichel, Yancey Medeiros, but it's the fact that, listen, Mirab Duashvili had a big fight against Cody Stamann. It had to happen. Mirab looked great. And you can talk about, oh, he had the takedown records before he fought him. But now we've seen Mirab get that big win over a good wrestler, Cody Stamann, and his striking looked really good in that. This is the opportunity for Gregor Gillespie to have that Mirab type of fight. Because if you go through 6 takedowns against Yancey, 7 against Paichel, then he had the 1 against Rinaldi, but it was all he needed. He had 4 against Gonzalez, like 5 against Glico Franca. You love to see those numbers, and you love to see the fact that he averages more than 7 per 15 minutes. But the trouble is, like, this is the fight that he needs to have. For Diego Fajeia, this is kind of like the comeback fight that he needs to have. Because before, like the Benil Dariush fight, I thought that he lost it. I thought Benil won. I don't see it as a split. Listen, a judge scored it differently than I did, but most people had it for Benil. But the point is, it was a fight of the night. He had a performance of the night over Anthony Pettis. Now, listen, I get it. Anthony didn't look good against Clay Collard. He looked good against Alex Morono, who we're going to talk about later on. But Anthony Pettis is kind of hot and cold, and Diego looked really good on that.
And that's the type of fighter that Anthony Pettis does lose to. Like, that's just a stylistic nightmare for a guy like Pettis.
But before that, Khabilov, that's a big win. Nelson, that's an all right win. That was on short notice. That's fair. Gordon, Olivier Aubin-Mercier, and then the fight that you talked about. He outstruck Mirbek Taisimov, a guy who has great leg kicks, and I talked about how big his legs are, but he really did utilize the leg kicks. But then we focused before even Olivier Aubin-Mercier. It's Dustin Poirier, Benil Dariush, and before that, I mean, you're going back too far, but you're still going with a knockout of the night performance over Ramzy Nijem, and before that, Colton Smith, who had one of the toughest runs in MMA, just in the UFC. So, you've got really different fighters here. You've got a really interesting path to victory for both guys. So let's talk about the odds because we need to. Diego Fajeia opened a plus 165 underdog. He's a plus 151. For Gillespie, open a minus 190. He's now minus 183. And if we have a look at Tapology for the total votes, 920 of them, 71% Gillespie, 79% by decision. 29% of fans have Fajeda to win, 60% by decision. It should be noted, too, that, again, you brought it up, Gillespie hasn't fought since late 2019, so it's been a year and 5 months. For the man himself, Diego Fajeda, it was almost, and it will be, about 3 months ago that he fought Benil Dariush in that absolute dogfight. He said in the interview with JHK that he only took a few days off, and then he was right back to training. I'm eager to see this fight, Matt.
I'm really excited for this. I do think Gregor Gillespie is going to make his triumphant return in this fight. I just think he can get the takedown on Diego, and Diego will be able to get the takedown on Gillespie. And at the end of the day, it's really just as simple as that. I think Fajeda can have more success on the feet, but only for so long until Gillespie decides to ground this fight. So I am ever so slightly going to pick Gregor Gillespie, but I do think this fight's going to be absolutely wild.
I've had a hard time with this one. I really have, because for Gillespie, look on the socials. I don't put too much stock into it, but he's not one of those guys that's out there posting glam pics every day, but you look at the shape this guy's in, and holy crap, like, he's been training every day. He just hasn't been hunting, fishing, and loving every day. He's been training in the gym at Belmore, and for Diego, you know exactly what you're going to get every time, but his takedown defense is a little bit suspect. Now, sometimes it works to his advantage. He can get taken down to submit somebody, but in a fight against Gregor Gillespie, he can't get taken down because he's just going to stay on top of you. And he's going to advance position. He's going to look to land some shots. So it is a really tricky one for me. I have the underdog Diego Fajeda in this one too. Because again, listen, I worry about it off his back. Is he great at getting submissions?
No.
Not 100%. But as the fight wears on, I do like Diego Fajeda. I like him with the striking. I like him with his jiu-jitsu abilities. And for Gregor Gillespie, he's got to prove it to me. This is the opportunity. If Gregor Gillespie gets this one, like I said, just like Merab last week, where he took on a tough out in Cody Stamann, this is the prove me fight. Merab was around the same in terms of the odds as Gregor Gillespie is in this fight too. If you want to compare apples to apples, I'll compare an apple to a crab apple. But this is what I'm going with. I am slightly going, though, with Diego Fajeda.
I don't see a world where Diego Fajeda wins this fight, and I normally don't go against you this hard, but this fight really does come down to the wrestling. My issue is that Diego Fajeda's jiu-jitsu is a lot more similar to Jacare than it is to Brian Ortega in this regard, where Diego needs to have top position to really get submissions. He can get the back, of course, but most of his submissions come from the top. He doesn't have the best sweeps off the ground. Can he get them? Yes, but even looking at Benil Dariush, Benil Dariush is a good wrestler. I wouldn't say he's a great wrestler. He's a great grappler, but he's a good wrestler, and he was able to out-wrestle Diego Fajeda. Now, he was able to stay on top because Benil Dariush is, I believe, a second-degree black belt in jiu-jitsu, someone who is very adept on the mat. I just think the top control and the overall pressure of Gillespie is going to tire out Diego Fajeda. It's a lot easier to fight and really have an elevated output when you're fighting against a guy like Mirabek Taisimov, who at the time was just fighting backwards a lot in that fight. It's easy to go out there and get a good win over Anthony Pettis when stylistically you're just a tough matchup for him. The fact that Diego couldn't take down Benil Dariush is just tough for me. I think Gregor Gillespie is going to ground him in this fight, and I do think Gillespie is probably going to win a pretty one-sided decision.
Can't wait to see what happens, Matt. The return of Gregor Gillespie. You got him. I've got Fajeda. I love the fight. I can't wait to see it. We've got a great card coming up. Cerrone's taking on Morono. Rodriguez taking on Watterson. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. So, Matt, we're filming this video on Tuesday to give full disclosure. We had to kind of wait to see how this card was going to shake out. But in terms of the seating on the card, I think somebody just took darts and threw it at a wall. You know that room that Dana White has with everybody's name that's kind of creepy? But it makes sense. Somebody just started throwing darts, and they landed on this fight very, very high up the card. We have the crochet boss, Maurice Green, taking on Marcos Rogério de Lima. And if you look at it, both of these guys came into the UFC off the Ultimate Fighter. For Maurice Green, he came in on the season of heavy hitters with my guy, Juan Espino. And listen, did he win the season? No, Juan won it. Did Marcos Rogério de Lima win the season? No. Shoeface won it. PFL standout. But if you look at it, for de Lima, he came into the UFC years ago. So far, 6-5 record, 5 of his wins by finish. If you look at it in his last fight, he didn't look all that good. He actually fought Alexander Romanov, and I've never seen a more meathead choke in my entire life. Romanov just put his forearm into the throat and put him to sleep, and that's just disgusting, and sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night with nightmares because of it. Yikes. But just
Alexander Romanov's in your closet.
Hopefully not. And with Maurice Green, you look at it in his last fight, he fought Greg Hardy. And the weird thing, too, you look at Marie's screen, I don't know what site you reference, but for me, I try ESPN, I try Instagram, I try Tapology, I try Sherdog. Usually, though, the best representation is Instagram. A lot of fighters post very often. You know, you got to build your brand, you got to build awareness, and you get an idea and a sense of what they're doing in the gym. For Marie's screen, he had kind of made that publicized change of camps to Jackson Wink. And then you saw him in his last fight, and I know we kind of joked about it. He was taking on Greg Hardy. Is he going to come out here and kind of fight like a copy of John Jones? Well, boy, did he ever. He kind of stood out there with his hands out. He kind of worried about the eye pokes. But that was what he did, and he was switching stances. The thing that Maurice Greene did well in that fight was he was starting to land some kicks, but it just there wasn't enough volume. He was landing the kicks, but not enough volume. And in one of the weirdest finishes I've ever seen, and if you check it out on the internet, and I make fun of Matt every week for this, a power jab put him down. Now, for me, when I think in my mind's eye of a power jab, it's the old WWE. You know, when they punch somebody, but they'd fake it, so they'd stomp their foot, and I figure, oh, that's power jab. But what Greg Hardy actually did was he kind of threw like a lazy shovel hook, and it's just the force of that punch knocked Maurice Greene down. Hardy kind of follows it up, and then he ends up getting the finish. Was it an early stoppage? Yeah, Maurice Greene seemed to think so. It was kind of wonky, but still, I was fine with it. You know, he got dropped. He kind of had his wits about him, but it was a decent stoppage. Rogério de Lima, very credited striker. Maurice Greene is a striker and has a kickboxing background. What are you making of it?
So, I don't think a light heavyweight has gained more weight since Daniel Cormier, and that would have to be Marcos Rogério de Lima, because here's the thing. You have to remember, this guy fought at 205 pounds at one point, and he almost tips the scales at heavyweight at the max of what you can possibly weigh. He's thick at heavyweight. And here's the good thing about de Lima. I know what I'm going to get from him pretty much every single time in the cage. He's got great hooks. He's got good overhits. He's just got good Muay Thai and decent takedown defense. It's not like he's going to offer you crazy submissions off his back or anything. Can he get back up to his feet? Well, he's not great at it. But again, with de Lima, I know what I'm going to get for the most part. He is a decent Muay Thai fighter. He's got, I would say, fast hands for the division. It's not like he's Stipe Miocic or anything, but he can string together combinations. My issue with de Lima, though, is he is quite small for this division. I do bring up the light heavyweight because he was at that division at one point, and against Maurice Greene, who stands at 6'7", like, we're going to see basically a thick light heavyweight fight the biggest heavyweight you can possibly fight. And it's not like Iwan Kutalaba's going in there against Alexander Volkov. It's not criminal like that, but it is going to be really weird for de Lima to get used to his range in this fight because he's going to have to get so close to Maurice Greene to land anything. But I do think de Lima's striking is just on such another level in this fight that Greene's going to have a really tough time on the outside.
You look at it for Rogério de Lima, and I went through the weights because his first fight in the UFC was at heavyweight, and he weighed 235. And then you look at it, he was consistently making light heavyweight until he didn't. And then he weighed in at 209.6 when he fought Jeremy Kimball. Now he starched him, but then after that, he missed weight when he fought OSP, and then ultimately he had to come up to heavyweight. And it's not like, okay, you know, he's an older guy, but he's probably going to weigh in around that new tradition of like 235, 240. It's 258, 259, like, and he's thick. And I get it. He trades an American Top Team, great strength of training partner, whether it's Nikita Krylov to kind of work your ground game, Andrei Arlovsky to work your striking, and so on and so forth. But Rogério de Lima, you watch him fight, and I think the perfect fight to kind of bring up, and it's well, Ben Sassoli's probably not going to hear it, but Ben Sassoli, if you go and watch that fight, Rogério's like, listen, I'm a one-round fighter now because I'm older and I'm a Muay Thai guy, and he just rips hooks and he rips kicks, and he looks amazing. And Sassoli wears it until he can't anymore and he falls down.
It's just that big storm is a big problem to deal with. I know de Lima's older. I know he's a smaller heavyweight. And I know cranks are making faces when I say good things about him. But like,
he has bad takedown defense.
But de Lima at heavyweight moving forward against anybody, especially a guy like Maurice Greene, who is so green in his stand-up, because this is my problem with Maurice Greene. He got dropped by Jean Valente. You need to remember that. Jean Valente, and I'm just going to say it now, is the worst fighter in UFC history. Feel free to comment down below if you know a worst fighter in UFC history.
Marcus Mariano.
I think Jean Valente is probably worse. He is just not good. And the fact that he was able to do... He was able to do to Maurice Greene what I think de Lima has to do to beat him. He got on the inside. He was able to land power. Now, Jean Valente just has the worst cardio and zero fight IQ. So he jumped on top of Maurice Greene and got, like, hugged to death while Greene was on the bottom. One of the weirdest stoppages in UFC history. I don't recommend looking it up just because it's so sad of a finish. But Maurice Greene was losing a fight to Jean Valente at heavyweight. That's a real thing that was happening. I think Marcus Rogerio de Lima is going to knock him out, and I don't think that's that controversial of an opinion. I don't think this fight's going to be competitive. I think Green has okay grappling. I know we've seen him in there. It's kind of weird, too, because I actually think Green's not a bad grappler. They've just put him against good grapplers, it seems, during his tenure in the UFC. I just don't know what Green can do in this fight to win. If he can get the takedown, maybe he can make something work in the top position. I just think I don't think he's a good enough grappler to get a submission unless he has like 4 minutes left in the round. I don't think he can just go out there and find a submission on a guy like de Lima. I think de Lima's probably going to knock him out.
I look at Maurice Green's run, and for the longest time, he's one of those guys, and I thought, okay, like, he'll eventually make it to the UFC. He's got that kickboxing background. He fought with Glory. He lost to Anderson Silva, not that Anderson Silva. He lost to Chai Lewis Perry, who had beef with John Jones at one point. He lost to, who else? Like fighters that are good at kickboxing but aren't like regular MMA guys. And again, that's poor example. Anderson Silva, the other one, and Chai Lewis Perry, who does have an MMA background. And then I look at it. So he has an LFA title fight, and that's when he kind of came onto my radar, started Fight Night Picks. He loses to Jeff Hughes. All right, that's fair. Both of those guys are kind of on the level, like they might end up in the UFC. Then he goes into the Ultimate Fighter. He beats Przemyslaw Musiala. That means nothing to me. Przemyslaw, old in his career. He loses to Juan Espino. Well, that's going to happen. Then he ends up in the UFC. He beats Michelle Batista, who's 4-0. That was Michelle Batista's only fight in the UFC. He beats Jeff Hughes by split decision, who did not look like the Jeff Hughes of LFA when he was in the UFC. Jeff Hughes did not look good. Then he beats Junior Albini, the big baby, who didn't last in the UFC that long. Loses to Pavlovich, loses to Olenek, beats John Volante, loses to Hardy. So I know you're not a ranked heavyweight, but where is Maurice Green? It's for a guy to kind of reinvent his style a little bit at 34, almost 35. It's just odd to me. Rogerio de Lima's done the same thing for a long time. So I like the consistency with de Lima. Do I feel confident in either one of these guys? No. Is it a pop and popcorn fight for me? 100%. But I look at the odds in this one. Green open plus 155. He's still about there. Rogerio de Lima open to minus 180. He's still about there. If we look at the fan vote and Tapology, kind of surprising. 921 total votes, 66% Rogerio de Lima, 77% by knockout. For the 34% that have Green, it's split. 27% by decision, 34% by submission, 30% by knockout. So the fans going with Rogerio de Lima. I'm going with Rogerio de Lima. I think it's just going to be an early storm. And if he doesn't get caught by one of those kind of long hooks or an uppercut from Green, he should be able to withstand it. But It's a wonky fight at the top of the card.
It's a bad fight for Maurice Green. I just see Marcos pressuring him up against the cage. Green doesn't have good striking defense. Rogerio de Lima has good hand speed and still has good power at the division. It's pretty simple. I think de Lima's got this one in the bag.
Both of us going with Marcos Rogerio de Lima to get the win. Looking forward to the fight. Let us know down below if you're going with Crochet Boss. Maybe like his Instagram stories or his Instagram live. But yeah, we've got Cowboy Cerrone, Alex Oliveira, and Marina Rodriguez, Michelle Waterson to take us home. Matt, keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up in the welterweight division, Matt. We have Neil Magny, the Haitian sensation, taking on Jeff Hands of Steel, Neil. And this is the first of back-to-back fights at welterweight, but this one definitely holds more water than your co-main event. You have a couple of guys coming off of main event losses in fight nights. For Jeff Neil, it was against Wonderboy Thompson. He got pieced up. I mean, Wonderboy on the back foot, one of the best counter strikers we have, one of the best strikers, period, in MMA. For Neil Magny, he fought a weird fight. And that's the thing with Neil Magny. Sometimes when he wrestles, he beats guys that have decent wrestling. He beat Robbie Lawler with his wrestling not that long ago. But then he fought Michael Chiesa. He employed a bit of a wrestle-heavy game, and it just didn't work out for him in that fight. So it's an odd one where Magny can strike, Magny can grapple, Magny can wrestle. Jeff Neil, primarily known from that southpaw stance, to be one heck of a striker. So I like the matchup, Matt. I'm eager to get your thoughts.
This is a really, really fun fight. I'm by far more excited for this fight than any other on the card. And no disrespect to the main event and co-main event, but you have two ranked welterweights. And really, welterweight is one of the best divisions right now. And it's weird because Jeff Neil, known as a guy who normally goes in there and can just outstrike anybody. He is that specialist in the striking. But we saw him get beat at his own game. And then you look at Neil Magny, and it was kind of the same thing. He got beat at his own game. So we'll be interested to see kind of where both guys' confidence level is coming back. Because for Neil, he went on such a great run in his first little run in the UFC. Just knocking everybody out. You could see the hands. You even saw a little bit of the submission ability too. It was just such a great run for Jeff Neil until the Wonderboy fight. He took so much damage in that fight, though, and that's something that does concern me, because I don't feel like enough people are bringing up that, because a lot of people thought, yeah, he lost a five-round main event against Wonderboy, it's not the end of the world, but the fact that Wonderboy did really piece him up, like, in the fifth round, this just goes to tell you what kind of a good guy Wonderboy is. Wonderboy hits him, wobbles him, he's like, you okay, man? And then, like, they kind of tap gloves, and then Wonderboy just goes back to hitting him a whole bunch.
The weird thing, though, for Neil going into that one, he had all of those issues, kind of injury woes, I guess I would call them, but he had some big health scares going into that one, and he had quite a bit of time off. It was just interesting to see him in that big of a fight like that.
I think we still both picked him, with all that being said.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So, like, for Jeff Neal, we know what we're going to get. He's that dangerous southpaw. The thing I like about Jeff Neal, we bring this up a lot, he doesn't go crazy when he gets a fighter hurt. He is very, very technical to the end, pretty much. He's not going to go in there and wobble you and then get crazy with his technique and get clipped like Koroshkov going in against Douglas Lima in their second fight. He's going to keep it technical and he's going to keep things short. And that's what I like about Jeff Neal. He's not a fighter who does things outside of his skill set, like Chris Weidman against Luke Rockhold throwing wheel kicks. Like, Jeff Neal, yes, his game is somewhat basic, and I know we talked about Dominic Reyes in this fashion last weekend, but it's kind of in the exact opposite way. Like, with Dominic Reyes, he only does a few things at, like, a 10 out of 10 level, or, like, a black belt level, if you will. But with Jeff Neal, he's such a high-level striker, he's just figured out, these are my pinpoint strikes, these are my finishing strikes, if you will. I've got my left straight, my left high kick, but he can also throw combinations with all of his other strikes and then finish it with those techniques. I just really like the striking of Jeff Neal, and it's something that's going to give Neil Magny a lot of trouble. And really, for this fight, I look at this fight a lot like I look at Lorenz Larkin versus Neil Magny. Really, any primary striker against Neil Magny, even go back to the Santiago Ponzinibbio fight, and I know Ponzinibbio is not now the fighter he was back then, but still, fighters who can go in there, use leg kicks, defend basic takedowns, and are really good at striking, just beat Neil Magny. Neil Magny's the fighter who, I referenced Ally Quinta earlier, if you're really good at striking, Neil Magny's going to take you down. If you're really good at grappling, well, Neil Magny's going to try to keep you on the feet. Now, if you are exceptionally good at grappling, like a Damian Maia or a Michael Chiesa, you can get Neil Magny to the ground, but I really do think Magny's going to be fishing for a lot of takedowns in this fight, while Neil's going to be trying to use that dynamic movement and the leg kicks of his, really just to keep Neil Magny off of him.
So let's make it not confusing for the fans and ourselves. We're gonna go with Neil, we're gonna go with Jeff, and we're just not gonna mention last names.
Probably
so
smart.
Jeff is gonna take on Neil in this fight, and Jeff has very, very good takedown defense coming into this one. And for Mr. Magny, he's got an interesting fight on his hands, because if he chooses to strike with Jeff, it's going to be a tough night at the office. And that's just the truth of the matter. I mean, the striking defense of Jeff is quite good, especially if you just wipe away that Wonderboy Thompson fight. It is really, really good. And that's the thing, again, with the injury woes and all the progress, he's coming out here hot and he wants another fight. And it's the same thing for Neil Magny. Listen, you get totally outclassed by Michael Chiesa, a guy that it seems like Kamaru Usman wants to fight him for the title. Like, yeah, that's a weird time. What are they doing on the desk? Well, how does Karen Bryant feel about that? Awkward?
I don't accept that fight if I'm Michael Chiesa.
But you look at this fight, Matt, we have Neil, we have Jeff, and for Neil, he comes into this one, he opened a plus 210 underdog, he's about a plus 157 or thereabouts. For Jeff, he opened a minus 250, he's now at a minus 190. So you can get Neil Magny at a plus 157, you can get Jeff Neil right now at a minus 190. And for the fans, we look over on Topology, 945 total votes, 65% going with Jeff Neal to get the win. There is a large percentage that I'm the win by knockout, 69%. For the 35% that I'm Neil Magny, 79% by decision. I'm assuming you're going to go with a drag him out, ground him out type of fight if you want Neil Magny to win. And again, the striking of Jeff Neal is something to behold.
So we'll be interesting, because if you go back and, like, Neil Magny, when he fought Robbie Lawler, well, Robbie Lawler, he's a powerful southpaw striker. He's got good takedown defense. And if you're on the feet with him, he's probably going to knock you out. A lot of those skill sets do parallel what Jeff Neal brings to the table. But the difference was that, well, it's not like Robbie Lawler's been fighting for titles recently. When we talk about Robbie Lawler, we bring up Fight of the Year in 2013, Fight of the Year in 2015. Like, it's been a while since Robbie Lawler was at the top of the game, whereas Jeff Neal, he brings a lot of those same strengths to the table, but he's much more in his prime right now. And for Neal, he's coming off a decision loss to Wonderboy Thompson. You know who else is coming off a decision loss to Wonderboy Thompson? Then they knocked out Nico Price and basically knocked out Tyron Woodley, tapped him out, and choked him out. Yeah, Vicente Luque. Like, you can lose to Wonderboy and still go on and have a lot of success right afterwards. and I don't think that's the end of the line for a contender on their way up. I do think that was just a really good opportunity for Jeff Neal. Maybe he realized, okay, I can't go in here and just outstrike everybody. There is a certain limit to my striking capabilities, and maybe against these specialists, I'm going to have to mix in the takedown, because Jeff Neal's not a terrible grappler at the end of the day. And for Neal Magny, last point on him, it's interesting, because I feel like Neal Magny's the only guy who's ever called out Kamaru Usman. Like, he beat Craig White, showed it to the Thundercat, and said, like, hey, short notice, like, I can fight quick. Neal Magny does, like, stay active. But he was like, yeah, I'll fight Kamaru Usman. No one wants to fight him. And this is while Usman was on his way to the title. I just like the mindset of Neal Magny, because Neal Magny, he's called out Chimaev. He's called out Usman when no one wanted to fight him. Like, when you have guys who don't want to fight, Neal Magny's the guy who'll just raise his hand and say, yeah, I'll do it, no matter who you are. And you always have to respect Neal Magny for that. But at the end of the day, I do like the skill set of Jeff Neal. And I just think the counters and the overall accuracy of his strikes are really going to cause Neal Magny trouble at the end of the day.
You look at it for Neal Magny, and I mean, the three-fight win streak going into the fight with Chiesa, it was Li Jingliang, Anthony Rocco Martin, Robbie Lawler. The Rocco fight was close. It was back and forth. It was an interesting fight. He looked great against Li Jingliang in that one. And then in the fight against Robbie Lawler, it was straight up one-way traffic. That fight wasn't competitive at all. Like, it was kind of a shell of Robbie Lawler. So he goes in, and originally it was supposed to be Jeff Neal. And then it was Robbie Lawler. So he beats Lawler, he gets Chiesa, and he didn't look great against Chiesa. And listen, it was a Wednesday afternoon main event. It was a weird one. It was.
The good news is, though, Michael Chiesa doesn't fight anything like Jeff Neal. Like, I kind of think we can throw out both guys' last performances just because Wonder Boy doesn't do anything Neal Magny does. And really, Michael Chiesa doesn't do anything Jeff Neal does. I just think this fight, again, is one of those classic clash of styles. Yes, Neal Magny's well-rounded. He can get it done no matter where. But we know he's going to be going for the takedown in this fight. So this fight, to me, comes down to, can Neal Magny get the takedown, A? And if he gets it, can he secure it? Because it matters a lot more than if he can just take Jeff Neal down. Jeff Neal's good at getting back up to his feet. He's a great striker. A lot of guys try to take him down. I do think Jeff Neal, though, as this fight goes on, is going to come into the leg kicks and the left straights. And I do think Neal's probably going to get the finish.
Again, I said it from the start, if I didn't tip my hand already, which I try not to do, but with Jeff Neal coming out of Fortis, you get Neal Magny out of elevation. You have a great, I want to say strength schedule, but both these guys have really good strength schedules. But they both have good corners with the Whitman connection, but also Saif Saud, but also the fact that you have great training partners. We already talked about Diego Fajeya in a recent fight. But again, if you go to elevation, you get the Usmans, you've got the so on and so Gaethjes, you can go on forever, Nama Yunus and so on. Now, do they all train with Neal Magny? No, they don't. But still, there's so many high-level partners there. The list just goes on and on. But for Jeff Neal, I like the takedown defense. I like the counters. I like the forward pressure when he needs to as well. And with Neal Magny, my trouble is, I don't know what Neal Magny I'm ever going to get either. And that's the thing. So I will go with Jeff Neal. To me, it's, again, it's an enjoyable fight. It's a pop and popcorn fight. I can't wait for it.
Yeah, I'm more excited for this card than, or for this fight than any other on the card.
Matt, we're both going with Fortis MMA Zone. Hands of steel, Jeff Neal to get the win. I love the fight. We have two more fights left on the card. One more at welterweight. Cowboy Cerrone taking on Alex Morono, the Great White. And in our main event, we have Marina Rodriguez and Michelle Waterson at 125 pounds. You're not going to want to miss that one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
The flowers are blooming. The grass is grooming. It's time to chop the weeds. Thanks to our sponsor, Manscaped, you can trim your holes safely and efficiently. I'm talking about ball trimmers, Manscaped, the global leaders of men's below-the-waist grooming, have an exclusive offer for our audience. Use code FNP to get 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com. Join the over 2 million men who trust Manscaped. And all the weird faces Matt's making next to me, they are here to make sure you're trimmed and smelling nice. And after all, it's time for some spring cleaning. Now, Matt, Spring, Manscaped has the best tools to get you ready. And if you want a funny grooming story, listen, I shave my balls all the time.
In the shower. We talk about it on here quite openly.
In the shower, fairly openly. And listen, sometimes when you're in a dark and dingy bathroom, maybe you're trying to be discreet, maybe you're trying to go for it at night, I would advise against it. But if you go with Manscaped, the Lawnmower 3.0 has an LED light. And you might think, hey, it's kind of silly, but I'm here to tell you that it's not. And I've shower shaved before. I bought the department store stuff. It doesn't get great. It doesn't do well. And at the same time, it usually rusts. And then you're throwing it out and you're going to spend another $40. Then a couple months, you're throwing it out again and it's just junk stuff. But if you go with Manscaped, if you go with their Lawnmower 3.0 in the perfect package, it's waterproof, the trimmer. And I'm not lying. And this isn't like, oh, a bold claim. I haven't charged this since I got it. When do we get these? December?
It's been a while now, yeah.
Now we're into May. We're about 6 months in. We got another 3 months of Manscaped, so I'll let you know how
it's
I make it.
It's not a month's work, but okay.
But I haven't stopped May, December, January, February, March, April, May. Six months.
Sorry, I thought you said January. My goodness.
So, you end up with the products. You get a great little charging stand. You can throw that there in the bathroom. People are going to be excited about it. If they do see it, you also get, with the perfect package 3.0, the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. You heard me talk about it, but you put a little bit on in the morning. You want to freshen things up. You're going to have a good day. You end up with a Crop Reviver. It's a ball toner. Couple little sprays, adds a nice, light, refreshing scent. And if you're feeling froggy and you're over on the site and you want to go with some of the cologne, the Refined Cologne, I can't, talk about it enough. It is a great, light, and airy scent. It's the same smell that you're used to with Manscaped. But so many great products over there, so many great formulations. And listen, if you're like me, you might need the Weed Whacker. I have a nice little nose hair issue. If a nose hair issue could be nice. I actually, I can't do a whole lot on air with the Weed Whacker because I went ahead and trimmed last night, so I can smell great. But all kinds of great stuff over there, manscaped.com. You got to use the promo code. It's FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping on your order. We got plenty more Manscaped to talk about, plenty more ball talk ahead in the months to come. I know it's a lot of people's favorite part of the show. Yeah. Great fights coming up on this card, so you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Really interesting fight in our co-main event coming up this weekend. You have Donald Cowboy Cerrone taking on the great white Alex Morono. And I say really interesting fight normally as a good thing, but this time it's not. It's for all the wrong reasons. I mean, Donald Cerrone was originally supposed to be taking on the Nightmare, the Dream, whatever nickname, du jour it might be, and Diego Sanchez. And it's unfortunate the way that Diego Sanchez exited the UFC. Nobody wants to see that. The guy's a legend. He was on The Ultimate Fighter Season 1. That was Griffin Bonner territory. And listen, you might not like the way that Diego Sanchez's career ended with the UFC, but the guy is a legend, and that fight would have delivered. I mean, I would have,
it would have been a dumb fight for Diego Sanchez. I'm going to be honest. I'm way more excited about this co-main event that we're getting than the fight that we were supposed to get. I really do think this is one of those rare cases where this short-notice replacement that we got is actually going to result in a more entertaining fight than we were promised to begin with.
I agree to an extent. I mean, it would have been a Legends Division type of fight if we had Cerrone Sanchez. Now we get a halfway competitive fight. You might not think it based on their previous records, but for Cowboy, yeah, it's 0-5 in his last five. And if you really want to break it down, I know we popped the graphic up there and I put a loss with an asterisk next to it against Nico Price. You might see it on Tapology. It has a D as in like a draw. It's a no contest. He lost a majority decision to Nico Price, but Nico tested positive for that dank herb, and that's no longer illegal by the Florida Commission as of today. But Nico Price looked pretty good in that fight. And for Cowboy, that's the thing. I mean, you want to talk about a gradual decline of opponent. Tony Ferguson, he loses that fight. Listen, did he blow his nose when he shouldn't have? All right, so be it. Then he loses to Justin Gaethje. That's going to happen. Then he loses to Conor McGregor. Then he loses to Anthony Pettis. Then he loses to Nico Price. What was the most competitive out of all of those five fights to you?
I thought Cowboy beat Anthony Pettis to the point where I got on Twitter and said Cowboy won that fight. Cowboy beat Anthony Pettis, and you can't convince me otherwise. It was a phenomenal fight, and it was just a great fight between those two, and it wasn't a performance that would suggest the Cowboys washed. People are going to stop saying this, and I'm going to do it now. I don't know if you're one of these people. If you are, I'm coming after you right now. If you think Cowboy Cerrone is no longer a good fighter because he's lost to Tony Ferguson, Justin Gaethje, and all those great fighters, you are insane. Cowboy Cerrone is still a very, very good fighter. This is the issue the Cowboys run into, though. He's gotten in his own way in multiple different stages of his own career. Let's go back. When was the last time Cowboy was on a big run? You have to go all the way back to UFC 206 to where he beat Matt Brown. And it was a great win, great fight. I know I talk about Matt Brown too much. But what does he do right after that fight? Cowboy Cerrone, known as the Cowboy, he will do it on short notice. He decides, hey, I know I just had a crazy fight of the year caliber fight. What should I do? Probably fight Jorge Masvidal in 3 weeks. And he does, and gets absolutely obliterated. That sends him on a losing streak. And at that point, everyone's like, hey, it's over for Cowboy. He beats Jason Medeiros in a weird fight, but still a great comeback fight for Cowboy. And then he loses to Leon Edwards in Singapore in one of those weird cards that I'm sure nobody watched in the morning. Spoiler alert, I also thought he beat Leon Edwards all the way back then. And I'm not saying that I'm just siding with Cowboy in all of these close decisions, but I did think that he did enough at the later half of that Leon Edwards fight to at least make it a somewhat competitive fight. If you don't think Cowboy won, then that's fine, but I thought he did enough to at least make it a close fight. This is my thing with Cowboy. Just because he can't beat the elite anymore doesn't mean that he's not still a UFC caliber MMA fighter. Cowboy still beats half the guys in the lightweight division. It's just guys who are ranked and guys who, I guess, are deserving opponents of the Cowboy name. He's going to have a tough time with it because he has reached the point that I kind of referenced with Randy Marcos last weekend. You're going to get worse when you get older. Like LeBron James, who just hurt himself, said, I might never get it to 100% again. Now, he says that all the time leading into the playoffs and he always goes to the finals, but still, as you age, you will steadily decline. And with Cowboy, that's just the case. Can he beat the top tier anymore? Well, no. But can he still beat most guys in the UFC? I would say yes. I still think Cowboy can go out there and beat a lot of, whether it be up-and-coming prospects, whether it be just kind of those classic legends fights, if you will. My only issue, I guess, was I didn't think him versus Sanchez would have been competitive at all. I really think Cowboy, there might not be as much tread left on the tires, but they still can get on the road. Whereas Sanchez, it's just kind of it for him, unfortunately. So for Cowboy, against Morono, I think this will be one of those classic Cowboy fights. Will he win? I don't know. But will it be an entertaining fight? I don't doubt it for a second. Like, I know the talk of Twitter is probably going to be Alex Morono versus Donald Cerrone, and it will have nothing to do with Michelle Waterson and Marina Rodriguez. Because wins and losses don't matter when it comes to Cowboy at the end of the day. People only liked seeing him fight. And I do think, again, great thing about MMA, this is why I hate boxing so much. You lose one fight and everyone writes you off. No one wants to watch you again. Cowboy's lost 5 times and I've been yelling at you guys for 6 minutes about how excited I am for his next fight. I just think this matchup with Morono is still an interesting fight because you've got Alex Morono who, he was kind of given that like golden goose in his last fight where it's like, if you beat Pettis, he's still a big name. So if you beat Pettis, like, okay, then we'll get talking. He's got another really big opportunity against a big name in Cowboy Cerrone. And I do think Morono will make the best of this opportunity.
Alex Morono is one of those guys. Again, you're coming in on 4 or 5 days notice to get an opportunity here. And let's focus on his fights because this is a guy that's put on performance of the night, fight of the night caliber fights in the past. His fight against Sung Kinnon was a fight of the night and he looked great in that fight. When does Alex Morono look his best? It's usually against some good strikers. And I mean, if you want to see a really, really good Alex Morono fight, and this is one that I watch every other week, it's Max Griffin. Max Griffin, Alex Morono. It's a fun fight because Max Griffin just kind of does his long, I'm going to throw a jab, I'm going to try and box, I might wrestle a little bit. Alex Morono lights him up, and then once he finally does, it kind of knocks the cobwebs loose for Max Griffin, and then we're getting into it. That was a great one. Other than that, though, it's weird, right? Because you look at the level of competition. How good Sung Kinnon? Well, sometimes he loses to unranked guys, and sometimes the striking looks all right. How good Zach Otto? Well, he runs Pura Vida BJJ, but, like, in off days, he fights Sage Northcutt to boring fights.
He got KO'd by Sage Northcutt.
And then he has a fight against Alex Morono, and Morono mops him. How good is he? Well, he loses to Jordan Meehan, who's always in your face, and he also beats Josh Berkman, who was kind of long in the tooth at that point. So for me, Morono's in a weird stage. He has pretty good boxing. He has pretty good kickboxing. He's an accredited jiu-jitsu guy, and he trains at a 4-ounce fight club, and he also cross-trains with Fortis MMA. So again, we talked about it. Diego Fajeo, we talked about it. Jeff Neal, also on this card. Maybe Alex is already going to be making the trip. I'd have to find an interview. But again, this fight was just made last night, made official. And it was weird because Morono's probably known about this fight for a little bit. Maybe, you know, there were some things said because the Diego Sanchez clips that have come out recently, those are old clips. Like, those are pretty old. So it's just a weird situation in general. But Alex Morono, the one thing we do know, he always brings the fight. Except for kind of when he fought Anthony Pettis, and Pettis just put on one of the best showcase fights we had seen in a bit, especially where Pettis really won one over. And yeah, it was like the going away party for Pettis. He looked great, then he goes to PFL and he looks bad against Clay Collard. You can't slag Morono too much, but he didn't look all that great in that fight, and that was just back in December.
Here's the other thing that you have to talk about when you talk about Cowboy Cerrone. He's a good wrestler. Like, in MMA wrestling, Cowboy's one of the better ones. I know people love to talk about collegiate backgrounds and being All-Americans, but do you know how many times GSP was an All-American?
You know, he was an all-Canadian dog.
Do you know how many times Cowboy Cerrone was an all-American? None. Do you know how many takedowns he can get in MMA fights? He can get a lot of them. Like, in MMA, it's one of the great sports where you don't need a background in a certain mixed martial arts or a certain discipline to then become really good at said discipline. Cowboy Cerrone, at least in this second or later half of his career, has really incorporated the takedown a lot more into his skill set and really into his game. Even go back to the Mike Perry fight. Now, I know it ended with Mike Perry throwing him down, but Cowboy was the one who initiated all those grappling exchanges. I do think Cowboy in this fight can get the takedown. I don't think Moreno's the type of guy who will submit him immediately off the ground. I think Cowboy, listen, Cowboy can get knocked out, but there's one thing you haven't seen him do as he's gotten older. It's not like he's getting submitted in all of his fights. And he is one of those fighters who a lot of guys are going to go in there trying to take him down because it's Cowboy. He is still that level of arrest or that level of a striker. I do think this fight will be nominated for Fight of the Night. With all that being said, I do think the forward pressure of Alex Moreno and the overall durability of Moreno can carry him over in this fight. Because if this fight was at 155, and if Cowboy was fighting unranked lightweight X, I would say Cowboy's power at lightweight would be enough to put that person out if he's able to catch them with a clean punch or a clean kick. My issue with Cowboy at 170 has really always been, and I know you're going to bring up, oh, well, he knocked out Rick Story. He beat Matt Brown. But that was Cowboy a long time ago. I just don't think his power translates at welterweight like it did at lightweight. And that's my issue in this fight. I think if Moreno can keep forward pressure and really smother some of the offense the Cowboy can have, some of those longer range kicks and whatnot, I do think he can have success. But this is the caveat. If he looks like he did in the Anthony Pettis fight, he's probably going to get lit up at range.
That's the weird thing. I mean, you look at Alex Moreno, obviously you're going to be fight ready. He typically moves forward in a lot of his fights, but he's one of those guys, and so is Cowboy. If either one of these guys gets backed up, Cowboy's not good on his back foot. I mean, you talked about the Jorge Masvidal fight. What was the downfall on that one? He started to back up, and he couldn't land anything. And if Moreno can start that forward pressure, I mean, think about Cowboy. My favorite memory in my head, it's against, again, a fellow Canadian, the Chris Horodecki fight that he had in WEC. What does he do? It's a classic Cowboy performance, and we've seen so many of them. Mike Perry, it's on the ground. Hernandez, standing up. Iaquinta, lights him up. And so on and so forth. The Yancy Medeiros fight, that was really weird. I don't even really think about that one a whole lot.
Still destroyed him.
But he still looked really good in that one. Patrick Cote, Rick Story, Matt Brown, Alex Oliveira, who's been in the UFC forever. Really has and didn't look good in his last fight. But when I look at this one, Cowboy was in a fight camp at the old BMF ranch with the Daniel Rodriguez of the world and who else?
Yair
Rodriguez.
Joe Schilling, your favorite chain smoker?
Stitch him up, Joe Schilling, a guy who had the best kickboxing career while smoking darts the whole time.
He did.
So many darts. But you look at this, Cerrone, fight camp for Sanchez. What's Sanchez going to do?
Wrestle.
Back up, stick his hands out there. That's about it. Like, Sanchez, you kind of had to figure he was going to move forward on Sanchez. You have to figure he's going to move forward and at least pressure a fight against Alex Moreno. So, Matt, let's talk about the odds for this one. Cowboy open minus 150. He's minus 129. Moreno open a plus 130. He's plus 109. Those odds are getting close. But this fight was just announced last night. The fan vote, 297 total votes, 70% going with Cerrone. Before you go, I want to know what the fans are thinking. Do you have Cowboy to get the win? Do you have Moreno to get the win? What are your thoughts on this fight overall? Because we're excited for it. For the nostalgia factor of Cerrone, you always got to get up. If Kid Rock doesn't get you up, then you're not from the backwoods of Canada.
We all know who's going to win the walkout battle between these two.
Yeah, I mean, Alex Moreno is probably going to walk out like Roy Jones Jr. Can't get hooked.
Alex Moreno looks like he'd come out to Eminem.
Yeah.
That would lose it. At the end of the day, though, this is a really hard fight. This is one of those rare cases where I have a really good idea as to what both people do, but I have a really hard time making my pick. Because here's the thing. Sometimes I'll know a lot about one fighter, and I'll have to do more research about the other fighter, and maybe my judgment will be clouded. I know a lot about Cowboy Cerrone, and I know a lot about the Great White. So at the end of the day, I just think this is one of those fights that's right down the middle. I am ever so slightly going to pick Alex Moreno because, A, he is the bigger guy at the end of the day, and if this does come down to that third round where it is going to be that grueling pace and it might come down to the wrestling, I do think the overall size of Moreno is going to play a factor in this fight. And again, it's not like Alex Moreno is getting finished a lot at 170. Yes, Chaos Williams knocked him out, but that was the first punch he landed in the fight, basically, that completely put him out. Other than that, Alex Moreno is one of the more durable guys at 170, so I don't see Cowboy just going in there, landing a head kick, and finishing the fight. I just think the forward pressure and the volume will eventually get to Cowboy.
You saw Alex Moreno, and this is a poor example, because again, Reese McKee didn't have a good run in the UFC, and we were higher on him the most, but a guy that had been a champ at 55, had a lot of success at 70 outside of the UFC, and fought Khamzat Chimaev and fought Alex Morono, and that was about it. Now he's got to go back to the minors before he gets a call-up. But in that fight, Morono mixed in the striking, mixed in the takedowns, was able to 30-27 on all of the judges' scorecards and really bring it together. Is Cowboy going to be able to take down Alex Morono? It could happen, but again, you talk about the size of these two guys, and it's a weird one because for Cowboy, he's the taller fighter. He actually has the range on him, but Alex Morono is one of those guys, and even if you look at the picture that we have in front of you, he brings that thickness. He just does have that thickness, and I doubt that you'd ever see it. Could you ever see Alex Morono cut to 55?
Probably not.
No, probably not.
He could probably, if we're being serious with her. If Cowboy Ken Morono can.
If Cowboy Ken Morono can. Cowboy, it's weird. Again, you talk about it.
He's 38, guys. Let's just call it what it is. Like, I want Cerrone to win as much as anyone would. The MMA fans still left inside of me, the one who's not out here predicting fights, like, I still like watching Cerrone fight. I still get excited when he walks out. That's never going to change, no matter how many losses he has. But again, he's 38 years old. Like, I love Kyle Lowry, but every game he plays, I think it's going to be the last one I see because he's 35 and I really like him. Cowboy's 38 in a combat sport where age really does matter. It's just tough for me to pick him.
Yeah, I'm going to take Cowboy in this one. And here's the reason why. Again, it is tough to pick him. And I did talk about the takedown defense, the thickness, being in the side of Alex Morono. And again, I'm pretty sure I might have had Morono to beat Pettis. And I'd have to go back and watch it. But if you look at Morono, he does have really good crisp boxing. He's not great when he gets backed up, and neither Cerrone. You have to expect the game plan Cerrone from Sanchez. I'm going to move forward. I'm going to strike. Just like a lot of the fighters out of the BMF ranch these days. But I do like that out of Cerrone. Probably a final send-off. You got to win this fight. You're on a five-fight losing streak. You couldn't beat Nico Price, who I hold in a little bit of higher regard than I do the great white Alex Morono. So I'm ever so slightly going with Cerrone. But again, pop and popcorn fight. You enjoy it from the seat of your couch. Have a monster and a Colorado Kool-Aid for the boys. But listen, I'm really looking forward to it. Matt's got Morono. I've got Cerrone. Who's your pick? You let us know. We got a main event that is something at 125 pounds. You have Marina Rodriguez take on Michelle Waterson. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time main event coming up this weekend on incredibly short notice. Up a weight class at flyweight, we have Marina Rodriguez taking on the karate hottie Michelle Waterson. And Matt, for Michelle Waterson, had one of the craziest fights you're ever going to see in Invicta at 105 pounds with Jessica Penne. And then they both end up in the UFC. And for Waterson, it's been hit or miss so far. I get the record. It's 18-8. But overall, she's been on big stages. She's been in main events before. And this is Marina Rodriguez's chance to steal that shine. Marina Rodriguez so far in the UFC, it's been a decent run. You look at the wins. You look at the losses. The one draw, of course, to Randa Marcos. The one loss to Carla Esparza by split decision. And then what does Marina do? Does she sulk? No. She comes out and finishes Amanda Ribas. We talked about this in the Amanda Ribas breakdown because she's also on this card. I compared her to like an Alfonso Soriano because Alfonso used to kind of always have his foot tapping. You see a lot of baseball players do that. But you go back and you watch the finishing sequence. And Marina, she's starting to pull back the left hand. As Ribas is coming in, she's pulling it back. She goes for the left hand, left hook obviously, and it completely whiffs because it sets up the right that absolutely knocks her down. And then Herb Dean has a weird finishing sequence where it's like, hey, I'm going to touch you, but the fight's not over. And then it is over. For Marina Rodriguez, very, very good striker. She has a win over Tisha Torres, old Jag, Jessica Aguilar, the draw against Calvillo, the draw against Marcos. And then to get into the UFC, she beats Maria Oliveira. But we look at Marina Rodriguez, great Muay Thai. But the other thing that she has, maybe not the best takedown defense, but when she's off her back, she's always busy. She doesn't normally accept guard, but if she is in guard, she's going to start throwing punches. She's going to start landing elbows. She's going to do whatever she can to try and discomfort her opponent. She did that against her last fighter, in her last fight against Amanda Ribas, where she was down on her back for a lot of that first round. And then once it was striking again, holy smokes.
Okay, so I'm going to agree with 90% of what you said, but there's one pushback. I hate that she throws strikes off of her back. That's the worst usage of your energy when you're on your back. use it to get a submission, a sweep, or get back up to your feet. Because you know who's not winning by knockout off their back? In full guard, Marina Rodriguez. It's just not going to happen.
Not yet.
And it won't, because she's not Nico Price with her up kicks. Now, this is a really weird fight, and I put Marina Rodriguez in the Nate Diaz, like Nick Diaz category, where it's like, I didn't lose, I just ran out of time, because she's not a fighter who goes out there, and it's not like she's getting stopped. A lot of her fights are very close, because in the stand-up, it's not close. She's going to outstrike the majority of people in this division. Like, Joanna would give her a good fight on the feet. Like, there's people out there, don't get me wrong, but she is one of the higher-level strikers in this division. The majority of competitors are going to go in there trying to take her down. We saw that against Esparza. We saw that in the Calvillo fight. We've seen that in the majority of her fights. And it does come down to the judges where it's, okay, what do I weigh more? Do I weigh the takedown secured by the opponent or the damage that Rodriguez was getting done on the feet? And for Rodriguez, she really is one of the more heavy-handed fighters at this division. And it's odd, too, because at 125, there's a few people who can go out there and get a knockout. Like Valentina, of course, can. Jessica Andrade can.
Araujo.
Rodriguez is also in that category. Like, when you are on the feet with her, she is one of the few serious power threats in this division, where if she hits you clean, you are going to go down. And I know we both had Hibas to beat Rodriguez in her last fight, but I made sure that we both gave her flowers by saying, like, if Rodriguez cracks you, more than likely you are going to go down. Now, did I think she was going to knock out Amanda Hibas as convincingly as she did? No, I did not. Now, in this fight, it's weird because Michelle Waterson, on a two-fight losing streak, gets a main event slot against Angela Hill. So already, that doesn't happen very often. You don't have fighters who lose twice and they're rewarded with a main event. She wins a close split decision in which a lot of people thought Angela Hill should have won. And now they're rewarding her with another main event up a weight class. It's just a really weird career trajectory for Michelle Waterson.
Now, it is weird, but we got to go back a little bit too, because if you go back, you look at Michelle Waterson, she was supposed to take on Amanda Hibas back in January. The fight falls out. And then who does the UFC call to fill in? Because if you look at this total card, it's an absolute mess. There's a reason why we were late doing everything this week. Cerrone was supposed to fight Sanchez. Holm was supposed to fight Pena. Flick was supposed to fight Figueiredo, and then Flick retired. Monteferi was supposed to fight Santos. Nicholas Mata was supposed to make his UFC debut against Demir Hadzovic. Then Francisco Figueiredo was booked against JP Bays. That falls out. And of course, your main event was supposed to be Sandhagen, or as John Franklin would say, Sandhagen, was supposed to fight TJ Dillashaw. And Dillashaw gets a cut on his eyebrow and doesn't do the Colby Covington thing and just glue it.
Just super glue it.
Just glue it. Come on, be a man. Glue it, TJ. Come on, Fat Tyler. But we look at it, they make the call. Who's reliable? Who's always on weight? And who always shows up to fight?
Angela Hill.
The TikTok star, Michelle Waterson. And we get Michelle Waterson. And I don't want to take anything away from her. She's been in some absolutely great fights before. And she's fought some of the best women at 115. And that's why we have this fight here. Because as far as rankings are concerned, it's 6-9 as far as, you know, when we're taping this. Rodriguez above Waterson. Waterson has a little bit of a name value where, again, she's already been in main event slots before. She's had competitive fights. And usually when she loses, it's by decision or split decision. So they're close enough fights. They really are.
But they're not. Like, the Joanna fight wasn't close at all. But here, my problem with Michelle Waterson is that her nickname has nothing to do with her fighting style. She might be called the Karate Hottie, and she might have a karate-style striking approach. She doesn't win fights on the feet, though. When Michelle Waterson wins, she needs the takedown, and she needs her submissions. And that's the weird thing about Michelle Waterson. You're going to hear about her kicks. You're going to hear about her karate technique and her taekwondo backgrounds. Michelle Waterson needs to take this fight to the ground or she's going to win. If she strikes Marina Rodriguez for 25 minutes, she won't make it to the 25-minute mark. I'm more than confident that Rodriguez could knock her out in that time, because you not only have to take into consideration Rodriguez has the big power advantage, she's the much bigger fighter in this matchup too. Waterson is outmatched by most people physically at strawweight, and now you're fighting a decent-sized flyweight. It's not like Marina Rodriguez is Jessica Andrade, who like fought at 135 and moved down. It's not like Waterson's going to be that small, but Waterson is going to have a really tough time with the power of Marina on the feet. And I'm not only saying this because Marina is coming off a knockout win either. She's been able to show throughout her UFC career that really power is something that she has, and it's not like her last fight was an outlier. In every fight, she is able to damage her opponents. Tisha Torres is still a really good fighter, and Marina Rodriguez beat the brakes off her on the feet, and it wasn't competitive at all. For Waterson, I've seen her in there with similar fighters to Rodriguez, who are that very striker-heavy fighters. But my issue is, Waterson's not a good enough wrestler to get this fight to the mat. If she was a better wrestler, I do think she'd be able to get this fight down more consistently and be able to work a little bit on top. But my problem is, she might be able to explode for one, maybe two. But then I do think that that's going to be it for her chances to get this fight to the mat. And again, if it's a striking fight between these two, I like Rodriguez an awful lot.
And the other thing that you got to throw in here, because I wouldn't feel the most confident about this. If this fight was made 2 months in advance, he had full training camps, it was at 115, listen, you could go either way pretty easily. This was hastily thrown together a week in advance. It's a main event. How many rounds is it? We don't even know. They don't even say. Is it 5 rounds? Is it 3? We'll find out. We have question mark kicks to kind of save us over on Saturday, so make sure you check that out. We don't even know how many rounds this is. I would assume it's 3 rounds. It's at 125 pounds. And the other thing, Michelle Waterson had that kind of fallout with Jackson Wink. Go over to the Instagrams. Back with Jackson Wink for this one. Interesting. For Marina Rodriguez, it was kind of like, and you saw from the tweets from Ariel Helwani, this was Monday night we're referencing. So Monday night of fight week, Ariel tweets out, Michelle Waterson said she signed the contract. She came out on Instagram on Sunday and said, listen, the fight's going to happen. I signed the contract. We're waiting for Marina Rodriguez. Hopefully everybody shows up. Hopefully everybody makes it to Vegas. We'll see what kind of shape Marina Rodriguez is in. You assume she's been training. You assume she was getting ready for a fight. It's just a tricky one to really be hard and fast. Yep. Watterson's going to win because she has good wrestling. She's back with Jackson Wink, and this fight favors her because she's been ready. Or, yep, Marina Rodriguez is a great striker, which I agree.
She is.
She's a great striker. We saw it in her last fight. We've seen it over her body of work. She kind of struggles with some wrestlers. Watterson brings a complete package. I don't know if she's going to be able to get the takedown. And normally, if this fight, let's say this was going to be at 125 with no other extenuating factors, Rodriguez all day. It's just tricky with all of that in mind.
No, I couldn't agree more, and I appreciate you throwing all that fine print at the bottom of this prediction, but I do agree. There just are so many other circumstances that, you know, it's just so hard to take that into consideration right now. For me, I am ever so slightly picking Marina Rodriguez, but by the end of the week, like, my pick could change every single day until Saturday when we do question mark kicks, if I'm going to be completely transparent with you guys. I think Rodriguez will win, and I agree with you. I think you did set this up perfectly. If I had no question marks around the training camp, if everyone was on, you know, both had 8-week camps at the training camps, they're going to meet at flyweight, then I would think, well, without a doubt, Marina Rodriguez is going to win this fight. But there is ever so slight reason to believe that Waterson might be able to pull off this upset. But again, at the end of the day, I'm going to so slightly pick Rodriguez.
The odds, Rodriguez open to minus 155. She's minus 212 right now. For Waterson, open to plus 135. She's a plus 171. Over on Tapology, it's going to be a limited sample size. 865 total votes, 75% Rodriguez to get the win, and 72% have her to win by decision. I've got Rodriguez. Good striker. The fight at 25 favors her for sure. We'll see if it's 3 rounds. We'll see if it's 5 rounds. I know a lot of people, they're not too jazzed for this fight, but it happens. And there's a lot of good fights on this card, and there's stuff to get excited about, Matt.
Yeah, 100%. It might not be Yuri Prochazka, Dominic Reyes, but it turns out few things are. So it should be a really great card top to bottom, and I'm really excited for it. I really am.
I am as well. We're both going with Marina Rodriguez to get the win. Make sure you check out the other Fight Night Picks content out there. There's an interview with Diego Fajeh. We've got an interview with Muhammad Usman. It's got a big fight coming up against Brandon Sales with PFL. PFL content, Bellator content, huge week for both of those promotions. So, Matt, it's a big week. Question mark kicks on Saturday. We offer the final picks and predictions 2 hours before the prelims. You can find it here on the channel live. So you have to subscribe and hit that bell notification so you know exactly when we go live. We're looking forward to fight week. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.